I will call to order the Tuesday, March 7th, 2017, meeting of the House Government Operations and Elections Commission, or excuse me, Policy Committee. Representative Freiberg, have you had a chance to review the minutes from Friday, March 3rd?
I have, and move approval.
Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes from the committee on March 3rd. Questions, corrections? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Our first bill on the agenda today is going to be House File 1117. I will move House File 1117 to be re-referred to the General Register. That bill is, author is here today, Representative Barr, welcome to the Government Operations and Elections Committee. I'll ask that you go ahead and present your bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is the first time in front of your committee. I have the requisite treats. So if the page would be so kind.
Representative, that's why we started with you this morning.
Get the important things out of the way. This bill is pretty simple. It takes the city of Oak Grove, which has been was a unified zone. The city was entirely zoned one way. It's been split into diversified rural and rural residential. This bill takes that zoning and puts it all back to rural residential. And to get into the details, I've got the mayor of Oak Grove with me, and he can explain all the details if you like.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Chair.
Representative Barr. We will refer to your testifier. Mr. Mayor, welcome. You'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to start off by saying first, I am not Senator Mark Horan of Senate District 32. Even though he says I smelled my name wrong, I am the mayor for the city of Oak Grove, Minnesota. I have been the mayor for the last 7 years. I've been active in my community for over the last 25 years. I have a lot of things. I know that you have a lot of bills on your docket today, Mr. Chair, so I'm going to try to be brief as I can, but to try to bring your committee up to speed as far as why this is so important for your committee to act on during this hearing. What's frustrating as a local elected official is that we have no voice. Met Council strips our elected election certificate away so that when we, our elected officials, and matter of fact, everyone on our city council, not only this time, but for the last four election cycles, also agrees that the Met Council's overreach has gone too far. So what I'm going to talk about today is basically bringing you up to speed very quickly. I just want to make sure that what I have to say here matters. Because when you're dealing with the Met Council, they have ultimate authority to take our wishes, our residents' wishes away. So let me start with this. We have the ability to run our city, both short-term, long-term, make planning decisions that make sense within the reasonable period of time. Matter of fact, that's why we have to do a Met Council's comprehensive plan. The problem with every city that's within the seven-county metro area is that you have to create a plan that the Met Council approves. So if your city is in disagreement with the global view of what the Met Council wants, doesn't matter. You have to submit a plan that they agree with. In our case, we followed the process to take our city back, and I've been involved since 1993 in my community. I've held every volunteer committee position, every elected position, and I even got on the inside for almost a year and was the city administrator. So I think I have a little bit of credibility of understanding the operations of city government, what's necessary, planning from our residents, what they want, and what I'm asking here today is House File 117, is to give us the legislative authority from you folks that says, Oak Grove, we have the right to develop the rest of our property as the most of our city. Our city is a northern Anoka County city. We are 36 square miles. What the Met Council did in the 2030 plan was say that we were going from diversified rural. Diversified rural, I know this is a lot of, I'll try to squish this up, but diversified rural means you can't subdivide any smaller than one home per 10. So for years, we'd have to go to the Met Council and ask for their permission. As an elected official, I have to go and ask an appointed body what we want to do, what our residents want to do within the ordinances that we set forth. And by the way, I helped write most of those ordinances over the last 25 years. What I'm asking is, and trying to get across, is diversified rural was the overall reaching document that says we can only develop so many homes within our city. When we started looking at what the Met Council allowed us to do over those years was to divide down 2.5 acres and go to rural residential development levels, which is one home per 2.5 acres. That's what we requested, that's what we mandated, and actually our 2030 comp plan requested that we had that ability. Met Council denied it. So in 2006 through 2008, we had to adopt a comp plan that took basically all of our city and stripped 2,600 acres and left it and have those residents, if they wanted to take 5 acres from a 20-acre parcel, they weren't allowed to do that because this Met Council requirement leaving it high density for future MUSA. MUSA is municipal water system, municipal system. Somewhere, somehow, someday, that there'll be a system pipe that somebody will pay to have put into Oak Grove. And then that area, that 2,600, will be mandated to have 3 homes per acre in that 2,600-acre parcel. It doesn't fit our community. We don't have 3 homes per acre anywhere in our city other than around a golf course. There was a forced failed annexation from the city, the northern city of St. Francis, and thus created a unique environment up there by itself. All the way across Oak Grove, it's 1 home per 2.5 acres. So then we took, in the last Thrive 2040 plan, we went to the judge and said, look, judge, this plan doesn't make sense. What they're asking for us to do is to strip away the property rights of those landowners and say you are not allowed to develop until someday, 2080, 2090, 2030, which is way outside of the Met Council's legislative action, to plan from 2017 to 2040. What we're talking about here is Met Council's authority, legislative right now. They have the ability to tell cities, whether it's a train, whether it's land use, whether it's whatever, and if it's in disagreement with the Met Council, too bad, because they said so. They're going to mandate whatever they want into your city, and if you challenge that, you're questioning the reasonableness of their of their wishes. I'm actually here,
Mr. Mayor.
Yes,
I do appreciate the background, and
okay,
as you pointed out, we do have a very robust. And you've been at about 7 minutes in your presentation. We want to kind of get to the things that you think the committee needs to know, so we may have some questions, and
sure,
we do want to take action on your
very president, sorry,
but
Mr.
we do
Chair.
Need you to
That's
get
fine.
To that summation point, if you would, sir.
Okay. The bottom line is what we're asking is the legislative action to strip away Met Council's mandate of that 2,600 acres and creating one area of 2.5 acres over our whole city. The bottom line is we're asking legislative authority from your group to allow us to treat all of the landowners the same in my city.
Mr. Mayor, thank you. Members, questions for the author or for the witness or the testifier? Representative Nelson, followed by Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the first question is, is this a city or a township? You keep saying city, but is Oak Grove a city or a township?
It became a city in 19... I'm sorry, Mr.
Yep.
Chair. Sorry. Mr. Chair, may I answer? Committee Mayor. Mr. Representative. We became a city in 1993.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that, and you kept saying, and I thought it was a township, and that's confusion in my mind. You kept saying city, and when you said about an annexation, usually cities can't be annexed by other cities. So that's why a little bit of confusion I had. Question I have is, I mean, we're going to be designating with this bill Oak Grove City. The city of Oak Grove is going to be separate, have separate regulations than the rest of the people in Anoka County. I think that's my understanding. I could be wrong there. But I guess the question is, in the future, if, say, right now I'm assuming that on the 2.5 acre lot you have septic systems and that, do you have connection to the Musa line? Is there a sewer line off to that area at the current time?
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair.
Committee.
Mr. Representative. There is no sewer system in that area. There is a failed debacle in East Bethel, the city of East Bethel, just to the east of us. That system was originally designed with four phases, an $18 million system. By the way, Met Council reimbursed the city of East Bethel by $9 million because they had to cancel phase 2, 3, 4 because they don't have the flow rates necessary for even phase one. So they don't have the money. They don't have the plan, Met Council, I mean. And there's no plan in the near future, 2040, 2050, and on, to expand that, and it would be over $10 million to provide that pipe into the city of Oak Grove.
Representative Nelson, follow-up?
I'll just thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this may be more of a statement. I understand. I've been reading the stuff about East Bethel and there was planning that they, as the way the development was looking, a lot of things changed after 2008 and the housing market crashed and development went way down in some of these areas on the more of the fringe of the metro area. I know one of the things that Met Council is charged with doing is making sure we have the proper sewage treatment plants and sewage to take care of that, because at times smaller lots in areas, septic systems fail and we have big pollution problems. So I'm just hoping that in the future that there's not somebody that replaces you in the future coming back and asking us now to overturn this and have to that you, because you need that the help of the Met Council. But Mr. Chair, that's about all I got. I mean, I've got some concerns about this, but as it sits right now, I'm not totally opposed to it.
Representative Joaquin Falvey, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor Cohen. I know we met in a previous committee, so I'm a little more versed, and you had a really great colorful map. Can you remind me what percentage of the city that we're talking about? You mentioned acres. I'm just trying to get the percentage.
Yes. I don't have that actual percentage. It's 2,600 acres out of 36 square miles. So if you want to do the conversion, I can get that for you if you need that. But it's roughly, I'd say, probably 5% of my city.
Okay.
But the way we look at it is that if you separate the rights of those residents, somebody's got to stand up and be the voice for those residents, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquim, it's about 11% of the community. I did the math.
Thank you. That's why I'm
follow
up,
Representative Joaquim.
I didn't have to do that. Mayor Cohen, so can you tell me, I share frustrations with Met Council too as a former city council member. I get it. We've had to negotiate with them before. Are there other amendments your city has brought forth that they've declined? Because from my understanding, you've had 14 amendments since 2005, and they've all been accepted?
Yes, Mayor. Mr. Chair, we have had 15 subdivision requests over those 20 years, mm-hmm. and they've always gone from diversified rural to one home per 2.5, which is residential. We don't allow, it doesn't fit anything smaller in our community. So there was one subdivision that was denied during the time of our comp plan rewrite, and this was time of a forced separation of that part of our city. It never went through anyways.
Okay. And then
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. And I think I bring this up because 14 out of 15 ain't bad. I know it's frustrating. And from the maps, and I was looking at your city, I've kind of gotten a grip on a little bit this more with the septic system and how that's working. Is most of your city septic?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor.
Our city is mandated. In our ordinances, we mandate a certain buildability. Part of that buildability requirement is a primary septic system area and a secondary for future use. If something ever happened in that primary, then the secondary would. And to answer your previous question, 14 out of 15, in 1993, most of our city was one home per 2.5 acres. Almost all of it was. So it got to a point where the total number of homes that were ever to be built in Oak Grove would never have happened unless you changed diversified rural to rural. So we were basically down to 50 homes that could ever subdivide in the 1980s, late 1990s, okay? If we didn't do that, we'd have to tell all of our residents, you can't subdivide, you can't build any more homes because we have this diversified rural over our entire city.
And then maybe one more follow-up.
I'll
move it along, I promise. It's my understanding with the septic and the soils, too, the reason why the southeast corner was kind of carved out is because a lot of it doesn't can't be used for septic because of the soils and everything. So that's why they looked into bringing it into the sewer line. That may come if you go more than one home per 10 acre. And I just want to make sure if I understand this right, because my understanding is that you'd be allowed to build density there, but the density would have to be clustered in a certain way. That would be under 2.5 acres, one home per 2.5 acres, and maybe that's more of the disagreement that you're having.
Ms. Mayor, can you briefly confirm her?
The bottom line is across our entire city, we have minimum buildability. That means soil requirements, modeled soil requirements, primary and secondary locations, buildable home site size.
Mm-hmm.
If one home per 2.5 acres doesn't meet on any of that property, there's actually 1,100 buildable acres that could meet our existing ordinance structure for a primary and secondary system. So there's no scare about a primary or secondary system that would fail either now or in the foreseeable long term.
And maybe
an additional follow-up. Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me the latitude today. Is it true that you could do more density in that acreage that we're talking about? It just wouldn't look the way, it wouldn't be one per 2.5 acres, it would be denser than that. I get that you keep saying that you're stripping land rights away, mm-hmm. and I understand that you may have buildability issues and citizens might want to do something else, but my concern is, you know, as a city councilor, there's plenty of times where you have to say no to people, too, because of the way things are working with your sewer, your water, your roads, your electrical. And that section of your area to have it say, okay, as a city, we can just ignore the sewer and the water and the septic issues, ignore them at council because we so choose, give us this pass. I'm just wondering what that will look like for the rest of the counties around. So I read the administrative law judge review, and I just don't think you're there that to come to the legislature to ask for that. I think there's other avenues you could go to before we do a precedent-setting law here. So that was just my
Again, Mr. Mayor, briefly addressing the question.
By doing a cluster in that area, what the Met Council's suggestion is to put a high number of houses in an area that's basically handpicked out of the middle of nowhere. There's no development to the south, east, or west that would justify that growth either now or in the near future. Clustering homes would also require a developer to come in and put in a temporary collector system that might someday in the near future, far future, who knows, hook up to that temporary collector system if a pipe ever was paid for push from East Bethel. So to answer your question succinctly, the 3 homes per acre, the cluster development doesn't fit, and believe me, I'm very adept at looking at systems both short-term and long-term and recommending to the neighbors that some things just aren't feasible. In this case, Met Council has forced their view on our city where 100% of my council believes like I do.
Before I go to Representative Freiberg's question, if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on the matter, we'll just ask you to get in queue, and James will get you squared away here. And also, because of the robust nature of the committee, and we just never know how long each individual bill is going to take, given our best estimates on this, the committee will reconvene this evening in 500 South. And on the pace that we are on today, it's clear that we will be reconvening. And it's anticipated that this evening pensions will be going from 5:30 until 7, so our reconvene time for those bills that we do not get to this morning will be 7:30, or the call of the chair. And I will keep you up to date as quickly as I can. Representative Freiberg, with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that update. My question's for Representative Barr. First of all, thank you for the treats. You know, some members, when they bring treats, really kind of skimp on them a little bit. Mm-hmm. You brought treats that I think are comparable to the average lot size in the city of Oak Grove. So thank
very
you.
Very good observation, Representative Freiberg. Very good. Good question, Representative Freiberg.
Yeah. Well, my question, you know, periodically we see local bills, kind of bills dealing with really local issues like this one. And they keep coming back before the legislature here in the Government Operations Committee. You know, we heard a bunch of bills already to make county auditors into appointed positions instead of elective positions. And I believe Representative Nelson may have a bill to just change that so that there's a statewide standard. I guess, you know, I know another area where that can happen is the liquor area. You'll see lots of local liquor bills giving, I'm carrying one myself, to give a liquor license to a city golf course. And, you know, so I guess my concern with this bill is, are we opening a door, Representative Barr, do you think we're opening a door where we're going to be hearing lots of local issues involving disputes between local and regional government in the future? And, frankly, my concern is that the legislature is not very well equipped to know, for example, what the average lot size in the city of Oak Grove should be. I have driven through there. It's a lovely community. But I guess just if... I'm concerned we may be seeing lots of these types of requests in the future if we move forward on this proposal.
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I would hope that we don't. I have another bill that's been included in an omnibus that would, part of the other problem here is when they did go to the administrative judge, the administrative judge was not allowed to look at the reasonableness. So I have another bill that's in an omnibus that would give the administrative judge latitude so that the cities and counties would have their day in court, so to speak, and actually be able to bring all of the facts to bear. So this should be a one-time, and in the future, you'd be able to go to a judge and get your day in court. They tried that, and the judge was not allowed to look at the reasonableness of the plan to say whether this is, 50 years in the future or 40 years in the future. The density charts that were included in the 2040 plan still didn't justify high-density housing in that corner. It's a 4.5-mile pipe to the nearest collector through undeveloped areas. So this was when they were talking about the phases 1, 2, 3, 4. Oak Grove was actually phase 4 of that plan, and phase 1 is 2, 3, and 4 have all been canceled by the MAC Council, but they won't give them back their unity in the city.
I'm still a little concerned, but I'll just leave it at that for now. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you want to come forward, and if there's any other testifiers here today from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee on House File 1117, please just get in queue, and James will make sure that you get in. Good morning. Welcome. State your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas. I'm with the Metropolitan Council and manage local planning assistance there. The Metropolitan Council opposes this bill for several reasons. Partly, a number of different bodies, different administrations in both the council and the city have been making decisions regarding planning in this area for the last several decades that have led to the current designation of diversified rural and long-term wastewater service that exists in that southeastern portion of the city today. I've included a couple of references for handouts for your reference that I'll refer to as well. You'll see that southeastern corner of the city. I apologize, I didn't bring enough color for everyone, so some of you have got black and white, but it's closest to East Bethel there. This proposed bill would disregard the decision-making roles and authorities of previous administrations at both the Oak Grove City Council, the Regional Planning Body, and the courts, as well as a number of studies that provide the reasoning behind those decisions. I want to point out one of the items that I've passed out is a letter from the City of Oak Grove dated 2007 that proposes, in exchange for retaining this southeastern portion of the community as diversified rural, that they would be amenable to bringing future MUSA, or Metropolitan Wastewater Service, to that area in exchange for the remainder of the community being designated as rural residential. This was a compromise that the city and the Metropolitan Council had come to in 2007, and subsequently the city updated their comprehensive plan, adopted that, and the council, Metropolitan Council, revised our regional plans to reflect those designations, and then went forward with our East Bethel Wastewater Reclamation Facility on this grounds. This bill presents a pathway that disregards any of the potential impacts of that proposed land designation change on the region, on the surrounding communities, on other agencies, and on the environment. And this proposed land designation change for Oak Grove would undermine the council's regional planning direction and statute, its infrastructure investments that were made to serve Oak Grove into the future. The wastewater ratepayers around the region would have to absorb that cost that has already been invested for the city of Oak Grove in this area. I also want to note there was some reference to administrative law judge hearing. That hearing was related to a system statement hearing, was not a court of appeals. In the court of appeals, anything can be heard that the judge deems permissible. In a specific system statement hearing, which is held under the Metropolitan Land Planning Act in response to a system statement that the council issues after adopting regional plans, it's much more limited due to the nature of that type of hearing. The city still has available to them to appeal any decision of the Metropolitan Council through the appeals court system and has not exhausted that process to date. I'm available for any questions. I'd like to be brief, but I have given you some additional materials. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
I don't see any member questions at this time. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, thank you for your testimony. Members, any other questions? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 1117 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Representative Barr, you are on your way. The next bill that we will be looking at will be, I'm going to take Howe's because he's back, Representative Hoppe. Representative Howe, I'll have you come in and we'll do House File 1101. I know you have an out-of-town testifier that's here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and he works nights, so it'd be nice to get him back so he can get a nap in before he has to go back.
Agreed. Representative Howe, I will move House File 1101 before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. And with that, Representative Howe, proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I brought the best bodyguard I could find, so hopefully the committee won't be too rough on me, but I figure I brought the right guy. Basically what the bill does, Mr. Chair and committee, is that it allows communities that want to do national night out things, allows them to raise money and to do some fundraising so the community can expend those funds and getting the police department and the community together and have joint activities. And so that's basically what the bill, and I'll have Chief Wagner expound on it.
Chief Wagner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and state who you represent, and then provide us some quick background as to how this would benefit communities from your perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Wagner. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Painesville. And I appreciate your guys' time today and Representative Howe for sponsoring this bill. This came up a couple years ago when I took over for the City of Painesville as their chief. We knew that when I took over, one of the things that I wanted to do was to increase the interaction between the police department and the community in a positive light, getting those interactions that the community can see us, not in enforcement capacity, but in a community service type capacity. So shortly into my time there, we started looking at our options. We looked at National Night Out and Shop with a Cop. Those were two of the specific ones we did. And the roadblock we ran into was, how do we fund these programs in a way that, one, is legal, and two, that we can kind of control what we're doing. In conversation with our city council, conversation with our city attorneys and the auditors, there really wasn't a good mechanism for us to be able to raise funds. The city is certainly able to accept donations, but in our city attorney's opinion, he didn't feel as though any donations we raised and were able to bring in would be able to be utilized for the purpose we were looking for. So we kind of explored our other options, one of which was working with other partners within the community and then also creating a 501c3. In discussions with Representative Howe, it's really, for a community our size, it's really kind of a almost a burden to look into creating those 501c3s. And basically, we're just looking to find a mechanism that the city can both raise funds and expend funds for these community-based projects. I guess that's kind of the background.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee at this point? Anyone else from the public wishing to testify? Representative Feiberg, followed by Representative Nelson.
Quick question. I know some cities, including the one I live in, split off from the National Night Out events a few years ago and have the National Night to Unite. Would that be eligible as well?
Are you asking the bill author?
Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg, I believe any of those types of events would qualify. I don't think it's National Night Out events. I mean, whatever you call your event, I think is up to the community.
Yeah. Representative Freiberg, follow up.
You just may want to look into that moving forward because it is a specific organization. So when you say National Night Out, I think it refers to that in the bill as it does. I assume it would refer to that specific organization. And I know there's another one called National Night to Unite. Just want to make sure they'd be eligible too. So if you could just look into that as this moves forward, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Feiberg, you might have missed it when we were looking at the information, but the House summary says National Night Out or the second bullet point for any event that is determined that will foster positive relations. So I think we've got you covered from what the House research summary says. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a good bill. I don't have a problem with it. My only question is, again, my city does a lot of things for National Night Out, coordinates with the police and the, and so I guess I thought they already had the authority to do this. I guess so, Mr. Chair, and maybe to the author, why don't they already have the authority? And I guess if they don't, it's time we pass this bill.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I guess going by the city attorney's examination of the thing, of the requirements, they believe that they'd have to do some type of an organization like a 501c3 to do this, to collect funds and to fundraise and to be able to expend it. So they're just looking for something, a clean way that says they're good to go, and that's what this does. It was their interpretation that they didn't have it, so we're here to try to justify that so we can fix it and give them a path to success.
Representative Nelson, follow up?
Sure, too many attorneys.
Seeing no other member questions and no one from the public, Representative Howe, I will renew my motion that House File 1101 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Howe, while you are here, we will also take House File 136. And I will move that before the committee to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. And with that, Representative Howe, if you want to begin setting up and explaining to the committee, House File 136.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 136 basically brings up the zero-based budgeting. And I know some people sit there and here we go again, zero-based budgeting. But I will tell you that having once in my career as a fire marshal had to go through zero-based budgeting at the city level, I agree it was a very painful process, but I learned so much about my department and I learned about so much in my budget that shouldn't have been there, that I am a strong believer that everyone should go through that painful. And then the next years that I, after I did the zero-based budgeting, the next years following that were very, very simple. In fact, it was easier than anything else because everything was justified once. Once I did it, if I kept that in my budget, I knew what it was. I knew what I had to increase. I knew it was very, very simple. It was painstaking the first time through, but after that, it was a easy thing to do. So I have an amendment that's not going to be offered here at this committee, but what we're looking to do is possibly phase this in over time as far as having certain agencies go through this so it's not quite as big as a fiscal note. I think the last time I seen this, it had a pretty big hefty fiscal note. And so in trying to keep that a little bit lower is try to go through and maybe do so many agencies at a time and try to get them all in within probably a three-year period or a three-biennium cycle. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Howe, I don't have any member questions that at this time, but there are two individuals that have asked to testify that have signed up, and if there are others that want to, please go ahead again. Get in queue, and James will help you get in. I have Mr. Peter Nelson, followed by Ms. Margaret Kelly. And again, we're all professionals on this, and I'm going to ask you to, again, keep your comments succinct and on topic as we continue. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You represent and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Nelson. I'm a Vice President and Senior Policy Fellow at Center of the American Experiment, and I've done a lot of investigation into our budget process. And as Chair Driscoll said, we're all professionals here about the budget process. I think we all know it starts from a baseline of what we've been spending, and there's never really any adequate review at that point of whether we're actually getting value for the dollars that we're spending, and whether we're still spending money on the right things or whether there's maybe some new things that we should be spending our money on that should replace some of those old things. There's just not a strong process in place to do that. And that's what zero-based budgeting gets us to. And it's very important, I think, looking forward right now. We are, right now, we've got $1.65 billion budget surplus. In the future, with retirees, with people retiring, with the baby boomers retiring, we are going to go from having five workers for every retiree, to less than three workers for every retiree in the 2030. That's going to create some issues for our budget, and we need to have a process in place, the best budget process in place, to deal with those issues. We also might have some more immediate budget issues on the horizon with the Affordable Care Act possibly being repealed and with possible loss of Medicaid funding. So we really can't afford, I think, these days to continue along with this baseline budgeting process where we just assume everything we spent money on before is a high-value thing to keep spending money on. We have to take some more serious efforts to review our budget and what we're spending our money on, and this is exactly the sort of thing that will get us there.
Mr. Nelson, thank you for your testimony. I'll have you stand by. I don't have any member questions for you right now, but there may be in the future. Ms. Kelly, and again, if there's anyone else in the public that would like to testify on the matter of House File 136 that's before the committee, please see James, and he'll get you in queue. Ms. Kelly, welcome. State your name and who you represent for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kelly. I'm the State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to House File 136 on zero-based budgeting. And I'd just like to start by confirming my commitment to the budget process and to the information provided in the budget document. The budget division at MMB has a broad set of activities we're responsible for. Preparing the governor's budget is one of our responsibilities. And while it is the governor's budget that recommendations that we prepare, we publish the document for your use. And our goal is to effectively communicate the budget and changes to it. And we consult every other year with House and Senate leadership, along with the chairs of Ways and Means and Senate Finance, to seek advice on the form and format of the budget document. So we welcome your input. We work closely with House and Senate fiscal staff to make what adjustments we can to the document to meet their needs as well. But I'd just like to remind you of what we currently have in our budget document. It's a 3,000-page document. We provide more information than most states do. It includes background narratives that take 3 to 4 months to compile and that are published in late summer, early fall, every even year. We complete fiscal pages, which provide detailed information on the base budget, which we publish in November of every year for your review. The governor's recommendations is a 6 to 8 month process that we publish in January of every year. While zero-based budgeting provides requests information at a lower level of detail than is published in the document, all that information is in our budget system and is available for your review. So zero-based budgeting is a concept that's been around since the early 70s. It's been tried at the federal level. It's been tried at the state level. States that have used a zero-based budget approach have not continued to use it. It has proven to be cumbersome, time-intensive, and an expensive process that did not yield the intended results. The National Conference of State Legislatures, in a review of zero-based budgeting, summarized the elements of it as being impossible to assimilate into a state budget process, and its techniques were impractical for allocating resources. I agree that people may have had some positive experiences, but not in a sustained way. I agree with the National Conference of State Legislatures when they recommend that we should be clear about what we want when considering zero-based budgeting. Are we trying to analyze all of state government spending at once? Are we responding to a fiscal crisis? Are we wanting a deep dive into selected areas of state spending? Or is it something else we're looking for in our budget documents? I welcome that conversation and the opportunity to ensure the budget meets those needs. Thanks.
Ms. Kelly, thank you. I did not have any member questions at this time. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 136? Seeing none, members' questions for the bill author or any of the testifiers. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's for Ms. Kelly. I'm so sorry. May you come all the way back down. I just want to make sure I understood something you said. You mentioned background narratives on individual items. Can you maybe explain a little bit what that is?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, certainly. Representative, we provide in our budget document a narrative description of activities within each department to describe what it is they do, who it is they offer services to, what the impact of those services are, and performance measurements that go along with each of those services. Correlate the base budget to each of those activities.
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelly, so do you mean for each individual program within those departments, too, or is it just a narrative?
Madam Chair and Representative, we provide the information for small agencies at an agency level. We provide the information for larger agencies one level below, which we call an activity level. Sometimes it summarizes multiple activities. Sometimes for medium-sized agencies, it's at a relatively low level.
Representative Joaquin? Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, you said that you were thinking of putting a timing frame on this so that maybe like once every, it would only happen once every 6 years.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason. Actually, it's going to, the timing to start would be in 2020, and what the plan would be then, and we have discussed this back and forth a couple of times, is one is to do it every so often. I don't support that myself because I have found when I went through it, it was fairly easy to continue that. The pain was doing it the first time. So I would prefer to make it so you just do it so many agencies, so many years, so that you would actually build upon and after, say, 3 bienniums, you'd have all the agencies underneath the zero-based budgeting. So that would be the timing and the phase-in process. I wouldn't recommend going back and forth between 2 budgeting processes because not only is that confusing, but once you go and do your zero-based budgeting process, it was very simple to maintain it.
Okay. Representative Mason, follow-up?
Just one comment. Maybe would this be worth doing as a pilot project and taking a few agencies, given the testimony we heard before.
Representative Howe?
That's possibly very doable.
Representative Mason, you may have a partner in your idea on this. Other member questions for the bill author or any of the testifiers? Seeing none and hearing none, I renew my motion that House File 136 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Representative Howe, you are on your way. Chair Hoppe, you are next, and thank you for your patience today. As Chair Hoppe is making his way to the testifying table, members, this bill that we're going to be hearing, the small wireless facilities bill, has been something that's been worked on in a couple of different committees in a couple of different years. And I suspect we're going to hear from the bill author today that it needs some work, and we've got a number of testifiers who are going to share different ideas on that. So before I move the bill, I want to, we've got about a half a dozen, eight people who have signed up to testify, so I'm going to ask them to start getting in order here. Tony Menendez, Amanda Deary, and then Laura Ziegler are our first three testifiers. So if we get in line, that'll help expedite things. And then as we start working through testifiers, I'll let you know who's next in queue. And with that, Representative Hoppe, I will move before the committee House File 739 to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Finally, this morning you have a bill in which we can say there is unanimity. Nobody likes this bill. Everybody likes the technology that's behind it, and I think people understand that we need to get there. And for those that don't know, we'll just briefly touch on it. Right now our wireless devices primarily run on 4G, and that is filling up. 5G, I have seen estimates to say 5G will be 100 times faster than what we currently have. So we want this technology. It's going to be great for rural Minnesota. It's going to be great for urban Minnesota. Everybody will want this. It's just a matter of how we get it deployed in our cities, and that's where we start running into problems. There is going to be a meeting, I believe, with all of the stakeholders on Friday that is going to continue the discussions on this. As you said, Mr. Chair, this is very much a work in progress. Our goal is to get something here that everybody will agree to, and maybe everybody only hates a little bit, and something that we can get to the floor of the House and the Senate, get passed, and have the governor sign it into law. So with that, I will start the parade of witnesses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. And with that, Mr. Menendez, if you will go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, state who you represent, and proceed with your testimony. And as is the case in the Commerce Committee, we also love brevity.
Good morning, Chair Driscoll, committee members. My name is Tony Mendoza. I'm the outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 739. A primary argument the wireless industry makes in support of its regulatory streamlining initiative is the need for non-discriminatory and competitively neutral access to public rights of way. The Cable Association shares that goal. However, without corrective changes to the language, House File 739 potentially creates a discriminatory regulatory environment favoring wireless competitors over others with respect to right-of-way access. Cable and telephone providers must obtain a franchise and pay millions of dollars each year in franchise fees in order to provide video services. But this bill would create a special exception from all of that for the wireless industry. That's not a level playing field. Even with respect to broadband services, this bill tilts the playing field in favor of wireless at the expense of everyone else. For example, certain types of high-density Wi-Fi equipment, which many cable companies in Minnesota are in the midst of deploying right now, would not enjoy the same streamlined right-of-way permitting process that would be granted to wireless companies under this bill. Fiber optic deployments would also not receive the same streamlined treatment. If there are going to be changes to the Minnesota right-of-way statute, the Cable Association believes those changes should be comprehensive, fair, and equitable to all parties. The Cable Association has been working with the wireless industry to resolve our differences with the bill, and we will continue to do so. To date, discussions about the bill have been bilateral in nature, with wireless providers meeting individually with interested stakeholders, and that is why the Cable Association looks forward to the meeting on Friday with all stakeholders at the table so that the differences can be discussed and hopefully resolved. Until we are able to reach that consensus, however, Cable Association remains opposed to House File 739.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. The next testifier, Amanda Durr, followed by Ms. Laura Ziegler, and then Shelley Hansen, and Paul Wirtz will be the next testifiers.
And Mr. Chair, while people are coming out, I neglected to say this.
everybody has been great to work with, and everybody, you know, wants to work towards this, and I think everybody's looking forward to the meeting on Friday.
Excellent. Thank you for the update, Representative Hoppe. We'll just have you again, we want to keep people in queue so we can keep things moving here. And so with that, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent and provide us with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Laura Ziegler with the League of Minnesota Cities. If it's okay, I'll start us off.
That's fine. I just want to make sure that we're getting everybody a chance to go. So that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, this is not our bill. Typically, the proponents will go first, but we continue to remain opposed. But as it's already been stated, we do have a stakeholder meeting slated for Friday. So we look forward to continuing those conversations. And as Representative Hoppe and I have discussed, it's extremely difficult to keep up with emerging technology and the law. And the League and other stakeholders are committed to try and find that balancing act. We believe one size does not fit all in dealing with these different technologies and actors in the marketplace, and that'll change in the next 5 years. We'll be dealing with different actors with the emergence of new technology. With this particular issue, one thing I really want to emphasize with the committee is that there is nothing in current law that prohibits these deployments from happening right now. And cities support the rollout of these advanced communication services. That includes 5G wireless. And this is why we are seeing agreements occurring across the state. In fact, I've received two different agreements just in the past week alone. So these agreements are happening within the current law. So the League is most interested in ensuring that any legislation doesn't take away a city's core function. And when I say core function, I mean absolute core function that the state has long recognized cities have, which is to manage and control the public right-of-way. And we believe this bill, in its current form, does take away the ability for a local unit of government to say where this technology and these facilities can locate. So statewide uniformity in this case means a way taking the local, taking away local choice, a city engineers, council members, staff to provide this core function in the communities that we live in, and that's through managing this tremendous public asset that is the public right of way to deliver essential services. Of course, you all know the right of way provides sanitary sewer, drinking water, stormwater, etc., and cities have spent significant taxpayer dollars to design and plan. And so we want to work to ensure that these installations can be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. There are often times that a public right-of-way can provide efficiencies in the delivery of important private infrastructure, especially with respect to technology. But even if this technology meets that threshold, there must be careful oversight and management. This bill has significant impact on our zoning ability. In fact, it would be completely stripped. And so even though it appears through some of the language that we could theoretically deny a permit, it's not entirely clear, and it could open the cities up to some liability. We also have some very practical considerations to consider with this type of technology. Regulated utilities and services are often monopoly providers, whereas there are multiple wireless providers right now. And so even they may have different technology designs or how they want to go about implementing their infrastructure or where they want to place it. We've been told that 5G wireless will result in 9 times more wireless antennas in every city. So, for example, if a city has 10 wireless antennas for each of the four providers, each provider will need 90 new antennas, and this would equal 360 new antenna structures. So we are asking that cities have adequate time to conduct a proper engineering review and other related assessments, especially if we see those CIB applications coming in. There are a number of other provisions that we have serious concerns on that we will continue to talk about. But for now, I just want to leave you with in closing, that these agreements are happening right now under current law. And there's also nothing preventing companies from placing their infrastructure on private property. And all we are requesting is that cities have the time to properly assess these locations on a case-by-case basis. So with that, I would like to have Shelley Hansen from the City of Bloomington offer her thoughts.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Ziegler. Ms. Hansen, if you'll identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Chairman Driscoll. O'Driscoll. I'm Shelley Hansen, Bloomington City Engineer, and I'm representing Bloomington and the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, which represents over 144 cities. Small cell throughout Minnesota is very important to our communities. We need it for our businesses, our schools, our residents to be globally competitive, but the one-size-fits-all that's in this bill does not work for all the communities in Minnesota. I think that's the main point here. There's a broad definition of wireless support structure. It's our street lights, it's our traffic signals, it's signs in the right-of-way, posts, kiosks, arches, utility poles. This needs to be narrowed. This is a safety and a liability issue. Traffic signals are problematic for us. They are a live running system. There's a lot of electricity and a lot of complicated systems there, clear view triangles, things like that. The bill also states that management costs are not included in the fees. Many cities are third-party management costs, third-party contractors. Many smaller cities, even larger cities, use consulting engineers to do their city municipal engineering. And they need to do that because they don't have full-time staffs in order to process all these permits and to process this the small cell permits. The definition of small cell wireless is problematic to us. It has a large equipment. Some of the enclosure materials, they call it concealment elements. They're taking away our zoning controls. That concealment element is not defined well. How that will be put in the right of way? Will it be safe? Will it be aesthetically pleasing? And as Laura said, it completely removes our zoning authority for these installations, and that is one of our core functions that we do for the right-of-way to make it safe for the public. Just some bullet points here. It hinders local controls, prohibits local government from setting separation distances between cell facilities. It prohibits us from having reasonable maximum heights of these facilities. It allows multiple locations on one permit when these need to be reviewed on an individual basis. The bill also says that the permits don't expire. This is very concerning to us. The bill limits the kind of information local governments can ask for in the application. And the bill states that no permit is required if a provider is to swap out existing wireless facility for a new one. They are in our right-of-way. This is safety for the traveling public when they're usually doing this. There's pedestrians, cyclists, and automobiles adjacent to that installation when they need to get up on those poles. The bill does not address the appropriate fees for compensating the cities for their management of these permits. In closing, the cities of Minnesota want small cell wireless in our communities. It is in our best interest too. One size fits all does not work for us. Right-of-way management is complicated. Sites need individual review. Definitions in this bill need to be clarified and agreed upon. In the last 20 years or so, cities have been processing the macro cell towers using our current process. It has worked very well. Sites have been evaluated on a case-by-case basis, both public and private. And the property agreements have been negotiated and installed successfully, with market rates setting the rental terms agreed upon between landowners and cell providers. And with that, I will close.
Thank you. Before we go to the next testifier, Paul Wirtz, I have as a person who signed up, and John Dukic, if I'm pronouncing that name correct, and Michael McDermott are the next testifiers that I have. And before we go to the next testifier, we do have a member question, and Representative Fenton, I believe you have a question for Ms. Ziegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ziegler, are you aware of a company called Bench Strength Partners?
Ms. Ziegler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, yes, I have been made aware of that firm.
And
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ziegler, are you aware of whether or not they're operating in Minnesota?
Ms. Ziegler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, I don't know how many cities they have agreements with, but I know that at least one city did have an initial agreement with them.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ziegler, and do you know how they make their money working with cities? Can you explain that?
Ms. Ziegler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, I've never interacted with the company personally or in a professional capacity. My understanding is they help craft agreements with these emerging technology and help cities where they necessarily wouldn't have other experience, and so they can contract out with them as a third-party firm. That's where the third-party contractor language comes into play with this bill.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Siegler. So I have some concerns, because one of the biggest complaints surrounding the bill and with the cities is that this bill will take away their local control. But as I'm on Commerce, so I've read through the bill, I've heard some of the arguments, and as I see it, it relates to small cell equipment, and it still leaves the cities in control of the permitting process. But meanwhile, there are cities that have assigned away their valued local control to a Sony consultant company in New York who is attempting to extort connection fees for as much as $7,000 per year per cell, when the price for the same connection with the utility, investor-owned utility pole, and that's federally regulated, would be about $50. So I'm concerned what this is really about. Are we going to pour a ton more money into government and having to pay a ton of money to somebody in New York to get this done? So I guess my final question would be, if someone does put up something the size of a pizza box, say, on a pole in the right-of-way, what is the cost to you as the cities or to the cities that you represent?
Ms. Ziegler. Ms. Hansen? Ms. Ziegler. Ms. Ziegler? Ms. Hansen. We're not sure who's got the toss up here. Ms. Hansen.
Chairman. Many of these installations are 6 cubic feet. They're a bit larger than a pizza box, and they have a lot of different weight and antennas attached to them. So when they're putting out a utility pole or a streetlight pole, depending on the type of pole, it has to have engineering. They're going to have to submit engineering calculations, which then have to be reviewed at the city. And we also have to review our electrical. We have to review the fiber run to the pole. And the fiber run could be running from anywhere, you know, from a block to a half a mile, depending on where they're at. And we have to make sure all that distance with the fiber and the electrical and on the pole, engineering, all of that's reviewed, which are different people in the city. It's not one person without all that expertise. So it goes to different departments for review, for cost. So the cost is, I think, believe you quoted $50. I can guarantee you it's much more than that. I'm not sure about the other high amount that you're asking for. I think that was for leases, not engineering and permit review. But engineering permit review is, it takes time to go through to review all those things to make sure that we have a lot of other things in the right-of-way. So it's complicated because we've got sewer, water, Excel, center point, all these other things that we're going to try to weave them all together.
Representative Fenton, any follow-up?
No, I just, I think that I'd like to hear what the cost is, and hopefully that will come out as you have future meetings with the author of the bill.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to Ms. Siegler. In general, are there other areas where cities have to contract with a third party for technical expertise that they may not have in their smaller city?
Ms. Ziegler. Ms. Hansen.
Chairman. Yes, there are. I'll just use an example. In our city, we do not have structural engineers, and we do not have licensed electrical engineers. So we contract out for structural engineering, electrical engineering, even in Bloomington. And then there are smaller cities, obviously, that don't have as large a staff. We may contract out for a number of different types of engineering.
With that, we'll go to the next testifier. And before we do that, again, remember I have Mr. Wirtz, Mr. Dukic, and Mr. McDermott. And if anyone else is wishing to testify on the matter, again, C. James will get you in queue on this. With that, we'll invite you to identify yourself for the record, who you represent, proceed with your testimony. Good morning and welcome.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amanda Dewar, and I am the Government Relations Representative for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Thank you for letting me follow the league so I can be brief and say that MMUA shares many of the concerns that were just outlined by the league. We, too, have been in regular conversations with AT&T about this bill over the past few months, and we do appreciate the fact that they've attempted to address some of our concerns. However, we need to ensure that the edits that have been made will actually provide the needed safety and structural oversight. So I'll continue working with the providers and the other stakeholders and be involved in the Friday meeting and try to work this out. But language remains in the bill pertaining to maximum heights and minimum separation distances that still prevents real safety concerns. MMUA is also strongly opposed to language in the bill that ties municipalities to the federal pole attachment requirements and rates. The state shouldn't tie local governments to federal regulations from which the federal government exempts local governments. This will only cause confusion at the local level and additional administrative burdens. And like I've said in other committees, Minnesota's municipal utilities certainly aren't opposed to small cell technology. Under current law, many MMUA member cities have worked out mutually beneficial agreements with wireless providers for the siting of small wireless facilities. However, safety is a core value of MMUA. Providers are asking to install these antennas on energized structures and near high-voltage distribution lines. So this local control and right-of-way management is prudent. And to just go a little bit more on the structural concerns, take a decorative pole or a street light. Oftentimes, they are not designed to carry much more than a banner. So it's important when we're considering siting these facilities on there that there is the proper structural review to ensure that they do have the wind loading capacity to safely carry these facilities, because it is the public right-of-way. So if anything were to go wrong there, you know, that is a public safety implication. So thank you very much, and we'll continue to be engaged in the conversation.
Mr. Wirth, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Wirtz from AT&T, and then Mr. Dukic, if you would, and Mr. McDermott, if you would also come in, and anyone else that would like to testify on the matter, and James will get you into queue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning and welcome. Just state your name for the record. Who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
I'm Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. Let me speak briefly to 5G wireless and the benefits of small cell deployment and technology. Consumers and businesses are using their mobile devices more than ever to connect to everyone and everything around them. From January 2007 through December 2016, AT&T experienced a 250,000% increase in data usage on our network. And as a streaming video continues to grow and new services are introduced, this growth in data usage will continue to rise. Deployment of small cell technology is one of the innovative steps AT&T has taken to meet this increased demand, to enhance our network, prepare for 5G deployment, and provide the best possible experience for our customers. With 5G, we will see speeds up to 100 times faster than today's average 4G LTE connections. Customers will see speeds measured in gigabits per second, not megabits. For reference, at 1 gigabit per second, you can download a TV show in less than 3 seconds. In short, 5G is the next generation of ultra-fast, flexible wireless connectivity. 5G's promise of greater speed and overall network performance brings huge opportunities not only for video, but also an Internet of Things, 4K video, smart homes and cities, autonomous vehicles, and the like. Small cells will be a critical component of the 5G evolution. Not only will small cells help bring customers faster download speeds, but also improve call quality and better overall wireless experience. Small cells help wireless providers deliver flexible coverage for people everywhere they live, work, and play. By deploying additional small cells, we can better meet the explosive demand for data and provide better service to our residential and business customers. At AT&T, we're aggressively pursuing our 5G evolution plans for 2017 and beyond. the deployment of small cells is critical to our 5G plans. This legislation will help clear existing barriers to ensure that carriers are able to provide additional network coverage in the most efficient and cost-effective way possible. Even when this legislation is enacted, local communities will still have the ability to say yes or no on our permit applications. This legislation has the support of the Minnesota High Tech Association, the Minnesota Rural Health Association, Medical Alley, and many other organizations included in your folders. Also included are resolutions from virtually every legislative organization, NCSL, National Black Legislative Caucus, etc., on small cell deployment. A recent study by Accenture noted that 5G wireless network could create as many as 3 million jobs and boost the U.S. GDP by nearly $500 billion over the next several years. In Minnesota, communities large and small embrace the next generation of wireless connectivity and will realize significant economic benefits. Minnesota needs to stay on the cutting edge of this technology, and this legislation will help attract the investment in the latest technology that 5G that will drive the economy. Finally, let me share a couple of quotes with you. The first was made by Perry Mulcrone, who is the business relationship director for Scott County, in a June 26 Minneapolis Star Tribune article headlined, "Better Cell Coverage is the Modern Railroad." His quote was, "That better cell coverage is the whistle stopper of the 21st century." Secondly, I'd like to add a quote from Jeremy Goebel, the city council member for Jordan, Minnesota. And in his email to the committee, he said, "As someone representing an ex-urban and rural constituency, we all know that the sooner this generation of wireless broadband is deployed in a population center, the sooner it will be available in less densely populated areas. This is why this bill is so important, and encourage you to move this through the process without unnecessary roadblocks." And finally, just to the comment that my colleague Laura Ziegler made, yes, we are in the process of trying to secure small cell wireless permits right now. Part of that is because we have our customer demand, but more specifically, we have a big event coming up here next year, and that's the Super Bowl. My company, AT&T, spent $40 million in Houston for that one event. But that was not a one-time, this is for the fans and the people around there. That is for the long-term benefit of Houston and the benefits that that will bring. So we're actively engaged with the communities around Minneapolis and Minneapolis to try to secure those permits, because it's going to be absolutely essential for the citizens and for the fans for that event, and ultimately for the long-term benefit of the Twin Cities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Woods, thank you for your comments. We have a member question. Representative York.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wirtz, currently under state law, are you able to negotiate with cities to put these in place?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are negotiating with some cities on small cell deployment right now. But what we're seeing, and I think it was raised in the bench strength argument, is we're seeing rates that are being quoted by several cities that we're not seeing anywhere in the country. And, you know, we have to wonder, is this being, I know what the price of coffee is in Minnesota, and I know what it is in New York, and we don't feel we should have to pay for the price of coffee in New York to provide benefits here in Minnesota.
Representative Joaquin, follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can understand that you don't want to have to go to each municipality and make the negotiations. This bill makes it easier for you to just have a blanket floor, and I get that. We just want to make sure that cities still have the availability to negotiate, because it is about local control. So I just wanted to kind of get that out there. I know this bill would make it easier for you to do business.
Very good. And with that, we'll go to Mr. Dukic, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, sir.
John Dukic.
Welcome to the committee. I'll state your name. Who you represent? Pursue the testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. MHTA is a trade association that represents more than 300 science and technology companies from across the state of Minnesota. And I'll keep my comments brief today, but want to draw your attention to a letter in your packet from MHTA in support of House File 739. And as we've heard, the world is becoming increasingly wireless, and as a result, we need the technological infrastructure to support it. Cisco, for example, projects that global mobile data traffic will increase nearly eightfold between 2015 and 2020, and that by 2020, smart devices will account for three-fifths of all devices connected to mobile networks. So as the world begins to transition to the fifth generation of networks, also known as 5G, that can accommodate large volumes of data. Minnesota must have in place the supporting technological infrastructure if the state hopes to take advantage of the benefits of these smart devices. Small cell technology will increase network capacity while enabling the future of driverless and connected vehicles, the Internet of Things, and new mobile applications. And with that in mind, we ask for your support for House File 739.
Thank you for your testimony. We again have another member question. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bekich, I want to just make sure I understand. I know the small cell technology helps link throughout and bring it further, but don't you still need grounding in like a broadband or a wireless eventually, like a point, kind of like a main sewer line versus arterial lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Words.
The way the network is going forward in the 21st century, we still have a major, the big towers are there. I mean, that's part of the infrastructure, but, you know, and they're going to be a key component, but we're not building the big towers anymore as much. The next step is really getting that coverage closer to where citizens are, and that's what small cells are. We use the term densification. It helps densify, make our network stronger, bring that coverage closer to the citizens. So that, instead of building the big towers, we're putting these small antennas in areas where there are large areas of congregation, festivals, et cetera.
Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you for walking me through the technology I'm trying to understand, but you still need, I'm trying to figure out how this would work in greater Minnesota where we're already having trouble with access and not having the broadband out there. You still need something to link these small towers into. So that's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and AT&T is actively pursuing a number of rural broadband wireless options. I give you a couple of references. One that we're actually conducting in Minneapolis right now is for multi-dwelling units, but we're able to demonstrate, and it's in the uptown area, from building to building, where there are a number of condos, we're able to provide service wirelessly from one building to the next at gigabit speeds. Now, you overlay that in a rural situation where you've got people, you know, it's not as dense, you know, much more sparse. We have a project right now that is called Project AirGig. We announced that late last summer, and there are 200 patents associated with that project. That is in active testing right now for wireless service along broadband lines. Another option is really technology that's already out there that a number of providers are doing in Wisconsin and other places called fixed wireless internet. In fact, there's a Minnesota provider here, MVTV Wireless, that secured a grant from the Broadband Task Force. So 5G is going to be part of that delivery. Small cells can certainly help in kind of a repeating situation. You know, just a comment from where we are. We've invested in Minneapolis, but we're up in Ely as well. And I think the people of Ely are enjoying 4G LTE experience. So then the next step is getting them that 5G and small cells to be a key component to that.
Representative Joachim, a last question before we go back to the final testifier.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to confirm what I kind of already thought. We still need to be investing in other mechanisms. This helps you bring it out to the masses in more dense fashion, but we can't forget this isn't going to solve everything. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just
Mr.
a comment.
Very quickly, please.
We'd like to be a little selfish here for Minnesota. My company spends about $100 million in CapEx in Minnesota. We want to try to get even more. And this legislation is going to help us get more to deliver those solutions.
And with that, our final testifier that has signed up in advance is Mr. McDermott. If there's anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 739, please make your way down. We'll get you in queue and get you a chance to address the committee. Mr. McDermott, with that, if you'll introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael McDermott. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Verizon. I want to thank Chairman Happy for championing this bill for us. He's been steadfast in his support to help bring the parties together, and we appreciate the League of Cities' willingness to continue the dialogue to make this a better bill. This is a jobs bill, a new technology bill, an investment bill, a broadband bill, a Minnesota first bill. Verizon's actually trialing in 11 cities our 5G network with consumers. So this isn't technology for 2020. This is technology for third quarter, fourth quarter 2017.
as Mr. Wirtz had pointed out, the industry in the top 25 cities in Minnesota, the industry is prepared to make a $1.75 billion investment in capital investment to bring 5G technology to the state. That's going to recognize a $3.2 billion GDP growth potential. It's going to generate 19,000 jobs, not building the network, but actually after the 5G networks are built, we project almost 20,000 jobs will be created because of this new technology. And we think it's going to generate, for the top 25 cities, $1.2 billion in smart cities benefits. I do take exception with the idea that this is a one-size-fits-all bill. It's not. Municipalities have a very important role in this process. They can review and deny permits based on safety, building code requirements, electrical considerations. They have a right to deny those permits, as we have a right to make cure those deficiencies. But if the pole is not able to sustain the weight of our equipment, they can deny the permit, and we as a company, Verizon, can offer to make a pole in the right-of-way that would be able to withstand the equipment and the wind loads and all the things that were brought forward. So the municipalities have a very important role here. They can deny the permits based on a myriad reasons, and it doesn't take them out of the process, and I wanted to make sure that we reinforce that. With my last comments with regards to bench strength partners, thank you, Representative Fenton, for bringing up the question about these third-party consultants. When asked about how much this would cost year over year to the cities, the answer was made really about the permitting process, not about what the city's costs are to have that equipment hanging from a pole, hanging from a vertical structure in the right-of-way like a streetlight. That cost, I think, is negligible. And that's why I think the FCC established a $20, $50 a year for the investor-owned utilities to charge us for going on similar type vertical structures in the right-of-way. So there are two different distinct costs. One are the permit costs that we pay up front, and then there's the year-over-year cost for being on the public's owned assets in the right-of-way. So I think it's important to make those distinctions in this bill. We're excited about this investment we're going to bring here. Help us spend our money. Help us spend our money in Minnesota first. And we're ready to do it, and with this bill, I think we can make it sooner rather than later.
Mr. McDermott, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any member questions at this time. Is there anyone from the public or anyone else here who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 739? Seeing none, seeing no other member questions. Oh, we do have a couple of member questions at this point. Representative Mason, followed by Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question as a statement. I think it goes without saying that this is another bill that is trying to restrict local control. And the impact of this bill is huge. And as important as technology is, I believe that the concerns brought up today should be addressed before the bill proceeds. So I do think it's important to vote no until they are addressed.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the first question I have is this amendment. I see there's an amendment in the packet. Is that an author's amendment? Or is that somebody else's amendment?
Let's find out. Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, I'll happily claim the A1 amendment.
Representative Hoppe claims the A1 amendment. I suspect the next anticipated question that Representative Nelson has is Chair Hoppe going to offer the A1 amendment?
I think he Mr. Chair, I think he answered that. My question, and maybe it's more of a comment, I understand there's still a lot of work to be done on this bill, and Representative Hoppe admitted to that in his testimony, and it sounds like they're going to be having this meeting this end of this week to get all the parties together, and I know from previous years and previous bills that Representative Hoppe has carried that he likes to get Greg Davids, Representative Davids' peace in the valley on a bill of this scope, so I look forward to seeing this later with peace in the valley at some time in the future. At this time, I say we should move this forward and let it continue. But like I said, I hope that when it comes back and we hear this possibly on the floor, I think it's probably the next time I'll see it, is that we do have that peace in the valley, that things are worked out.
Representative Hoppe, to the A1 amendment, did you want to offer that? I understand that there might be some oral corrections that need to be done in the amendment as well in my conversations offline here with Ms. Dyson.
That sounds good to me, Mr. Chair. And I would, yes, we'd like to offer the A1 amendment. And if you want to
offer that, I would be appreciative.
Yeah, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 739. And with that, Ms. Dyson, you did have a couple of technical corrections that you wanted to offer. So, members, if you want to locate that amendment, we can go through some of the corrections that Ms. Dyson has cited in here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the A1 amendment on line 1.4, where it says page 5, line 15, after and, there are two ands in that, page 5. There are two ands, and it is the first and. So just to clarify that it's the first and we're inserting for co-location on wireless support. The second correction is on of the amendment line 10, where it says wireless facility or a wireless. It should be wireless facility on a wireless support structure.
So changing the word or to on?
Yeah. And then the last correction is an addition, where it says on line 114, page 7, line 31, delete 60, insert 90. It should also have page 7, line 32, delete 60, and insert 90.
Ms. Dyson, should we take those as incorporations or should we take those as oral amendments?
Mr. Chair, I believe they can be incorporated by you as the author of the amendment, if that's agreeable to Representative.
Is Chair Hoppe, you're okay with those?
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Then we'll incorporate
my apologies
those.
For the little missteps here. And Ms. Dyson, thank you for your corrections.
With that, any other questions on the A1 amendment to House File 739? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Representative Nelson, are you good with questions?
Yes, I am.
Okay, then Representative Joaquin, followed by Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hoppe, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I know Representative Sanders worked hard on this bill last year or the year before. It all blends together.
He's fading from our memory.
And I really do appreciate the fact that you're trying really hard to find a compromise, and I think you will. It does concern me. Is the next step the floor?
Representative Joaquin, the next step for this is jobs and energy.
Okay. Oh, that makes me feel much better that there's going to be another committee looking at this,
me
even
too.
Though the local control aspects really do belong in our jurisdiction and not in jobs. I only had one clarifying question just so that I can understand. I know it allows the city to deny a permit for, I think it was safety, health, and something else. I'm wondering under the safety definition, and maybe this is for council, I don't know if we have a good definition of that in statute, but for safety in the right-of-way, what was presented earlier was like, you know, the amount of weight that's on the pole, things like that. Does safety also equal visibility? Because these are in the right-of-way, how close they can be located to stop signs. I mean, I just want to make sure that there is still local control on issues other than maybe health and the weight of the item.
Representative Joaquin, to your question, who are you addressing that to or would
not
like to
sure.
have
who can
answer that?
It? Whoever, maybe Ms. Dyson.
Now, anybody in the audience that wants to
anybody?
Jump in, too,
anybody?
Now is a great time. So, Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, in the bill on page 7, I believe this is what you're referring to, where it says, in processing and approving a co-location permit, a local government unit may condition its approval on compliance with, and the first item is generally applicable health, safety, and welfare conditions. There is a definition on the next page, page 8, line 824 to 27, that says, for the purposes of this subdivision, generally applicable health, safety, and welfare regulations mean uniform building, fire, electrical, plumbing, or mechanical codes under Minnesota law.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. That I did see that, and that's what made me concerned about the visibility aspect since they are in the right-of-way. Maybe that's something that you can look at. I know that cities, a lot of times, they're asked to approve permits that they really can't deny anyway, because they have to find specific findings of fact that are in state statute, and those findings of fact aren't solid, they can end up in court. So maybe that's an area, if you're looking for some peace in the valley with local control, on expanding some of those definitions so cities have a little bit more teeth, that it's not one of those things like, oh, we have to come to you for a permit, but you really can't deny it. So thank you.
Chair Hockey, comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Joachim, I'll see what I can do.
With that, we'll go to Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, you're right. It's far better authorship this year. You know, I've had a lot of folks from both sides in my office, and I'm pleased to hear about the meeting that's coming up. You know, I found from personal experience at working with the league, you can reach a level of compromise that creates a sense of neutrality or acceptance. And this is a very important technological advancement that we need to make sure that we're taking seriously, because folks around the state are needing it. And I'm looking forward to hearing the results of the Friday meeting.
Representative Hockey, your meeting on Friday sounds like it's going to be well attended. There are no suites that are available at that particular meeting, are there? That's been a topic of other discussion around here. Just want to make sure that we're okay on that.
I think we're okay, Mr. Chair.
And using your line, I thought that would be funnier than it was. With that, Representative Hoppe, we will give you the final word.
Well, Mr. Chair, did we vote on the...
We sure did.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your time.
They're telling me we didn't. I believe we did. Let's just do it again. Then we got the belt and suspenders.
Okay.
I think I said I will incorporate those, and all those in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 739 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Now for sure we've got it.
Excellent use of belt and suspenders, Mr. Chair. I think everybody could see here that we all understand 5G technology that's coming and people want it. I think you can also see the need for the meeting on Friday. And I'm looking forward to the meeting on Friday and the results of that. And I hope that we can have a good outcome and get something good in the Jobs Committee, where we have something that we can bring to the floor and everybody will be happy.
With that, and no other member questions, no other public testimony, I will renew my motion that House File 739, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. You are on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill that we have before us is House File H-28. And given the fact that we have session at 12:15, we're going to have a hard stop at 12 o'clock so that members can make their way to the Capitol and to session. My best judgment tells me that we will get to House File H-28 today, this morning, and again, the committee will recess and then reconvene at 7:30 p.m. or the call of the chair and 500 South later today. With that, Representative Albright, I will bring forward and move in front of the committee House File H-28 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. If they'll proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Brevity will be my friend, as it will be your ally for the next 14 minutes. And so with that, members, this is a Met Council Governance Restructuring and Reformation Bill. And as I conclude my very brief remarks, I have two testifiers that will be coming forward to give their a review of their participation in the Met Council from their council perspective and mayoral perspective. But this is not something new to this committee. We certainly discussed this robustly last term, and we are renewing our intention and desire to bring some additional accountability to the matter at hand, that being the Met Council. Mr. Chair, with that, I do have two testifiers, Mayor Mark Corn from Oak Grove and Mayor Bob Crawford from Elko New Market, that would like to provide some remarks to the committee.
With that, we'll bring forward your two testifiers. If they would be making their way. And again, members, we have 12 minutes left to take the testifiers, and we have two others that have signed up to testify. Member questions, as well as any other public testimony. With that, welcome to the committee, Mayor. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Mayor Bob Crawford, Elko New Market. Our city passed the resolution from the Governance Reform Committee from the four counties and a group of cities. We also had two representatives that served on that committee. So we support the changes. our council has not come out with anything as far as a resolution to support the bill or not. So today I'm just testifying as myself on the part where I've heard that they say that local officials wouldn't have time to serve on the Met Council. And as local officials, we make a lot of choices in where we put our time. I myself go to the Regional Council of Mayors. I participate in all the policy committees for metro cities. I do numerous other things. I'm chair at Scale in Scott County. I do a lot of other things outside my city as mayor. So it's a choice on how much time you put in. If I was going to serve on the Met Council, I would probably have to give up, as an elected official, I would have to give up some of these other optional duties and optional things that I do serving other places. But everything we do is a choice. And I think there are a lot of elected officials who would represent the region well serving on the Met Council. Like I said, it would be a choice for them that they would have to maybe give up some of the other things besides just, you know, besides the fact being just their elected official in their community. They wouldn't be able to serve on a lot of other outside committees because they would fill up their schedule. But everything is a choice, and I just believe that elected officials could do it, and they do it in other parts of the country very well.
Mayor Crawford, thank you for your testimony, sir. And Mayor, we'll come back to you. And again, we do need brevity, and I'm going to need to enforce that along the way. So I know you've had a chance to share some of your thoughts, and maybe you just want to add on a few other ideas this afternoon or this morning.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I would like to say...
Please identify yourself again for the record.
I'm sorry. Mayor Mark Clark, City of Oak Grove, Minnesota. In preparing and being asked to speak on this issue, I was approached by a number of mayors and a number of city council members that all have the same concern. Local control. We need changes of this organization called Met Council. Getting elected officials, people with election certificates on this committee is one first step at what our council believes is only a minor step in making major changes that brings back local control to our communities. I was a part of the steering committee. I've been part of all this, these actions going forward. I think it's really important that that we have a way to have a say as elected officials. And with that, because I've told most of my story earlier, I'm gonna say thank you for allowing me to speak on this issue.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't see any member questions for either of the mayors at this time, but the thanks of the committee. And with that, I have... Patricia Newman and James Hovland, who have asked to testify, if they would make their way to the testifying table. And again, if there's any other members of the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 828 will get you in queue, and James can help you with that. Ms. Newman, welcome. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patricia Newman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing 90 cities in the metropolitan area, encompassing over 95% of the region's population. Metro City's policies do support reforms to the governance structure of the Metropolitan Council, including the provision of staggered terms and improvements to the nominating committee process that would increase transparency and better involve local government officials at the front end of the selection process for Met Council members. Further, Metro City's policies do support high collaboration and partnership between local officials and the Metropolitan Council. Metro City's policies do respectfully oppose House File 828, which would require the Metropolitan Council to be made up of local officials and would eliminate the Transportation Advisory Board. The reason for the policies opposing this bill are due to what we believe are the high incompatibility of these two offices that would put local officials at significant risk for conflicts of interest, for the perception of conflicts, both of which undermine public trust. The legislature and Minnesota in general has spent a lot of time on issues of ethics and conflicts of interest and has been a front runner in the country with strong laws that strengthen strong ethics for the state. We believe that this bill would take the governance structure of the Met Council or any entity along this line in the opposite direction. Metro Cities had a task force on this issue several years ago, and one of the other considerations that the task force addressed was the fact that city officials, unlike county commissioners who would also serve on the council under this bill, do not serve in their city role full time, and it is not practical to require them to assume another public office. The time commitments would simply be too great for most city officials to shoulder. It may be fine for some or a few, but having a narrow pool from which to draw membership for the council would again undermine the integrity of the selection process. Metro Cities does again improve accountability and transparency for the council as the bill's proponents have sought, and in fact our policies support having transparency and accountability across all sectors of Metropolitan Council policy and activity. But we do respectfully oppose House File 828 due to what we believe are the incompatibilities associated with these two offices. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Newman, thank you for your testimony. I do not see any questions or have any member questions at this time. And Mr. Hovland, Ms. Newman.
Mr. Sean Kirscher from the Citizens League is here. Mr. Hovland had to leave, unfortunately.
Very good. That helps us to clarify. Sir, if you'll come forward and state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sean Kirscher. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens League. I'm here to speak respectfully in opposition to this specific bill. The Citizens League was the original authors of the Met Council 50 years ago. However, we believe reform is needed today. We instigated a study committee from September 2015 to March 2016 that recommended specific reforms. Our criteria were that it should preserve the Met Council as a regional planning and operating entity. It should address concerns that have been raised and people have already spoken towards today, and that the recommendations should be politically plausible. We recommended specifically staggered terms, a change in the nomination process to include more city and county voices, changes to make the nominations process more transparent, and clarification on the qualifications. We agree with Ms. Naumann that this raises perceived and potential conflicts of interest and authority. Our concern is that it would make the council too parochial and it would interfere with its long-term regional goals, and that we think by taking all of the authority from the governor, it would not be politically plausible. We do agree that there would put significant time constraints on serving effectively in the multiple roles, elected office, Met Council, and other employment. In short, we think it would create bigger problems than the ones that we're trying to address. We think reform is needed, but again, we respectfully oppose these specific recommendations.
Sir, thank you for your testimony. There anyone else that would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 828? Seeing none, member questions? Seeing none, Representative Albright, we will give you the final word on the bill this morning. Representative Freiberg.
I have a lot, I guess, just for the record, I feel, I know we're short on time here, but I do have a lot of concerns with this. We're essentially putting, I just looked, just one provision of it. There's a county commissioner from each metro area county. I live in Hennepin County, and the population is 1.15 million. Washington County, the population is 238,000. You're essentially giving disproportionate weight to smaller population counties there, as well as all the concerns raised about conflicts of interests and so forth. So I personally have a lot of concerns with this.
Other questions on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Albright, we will give you the final word, keeping in mind we have 2 minutes left before we hit the 12 o'clock hard break. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair and members. House File 828.
The bill will be laid over indefinitely.
My apologies, Madam. Mr. Chair, my apologies. It has been a long morning thus far for testifying. And with that, and brevity being the only friend I may have left in this committee, I will leave it at that. Thank you for your attention to the matter, and understand that we will be coming back late tonight to review House File 1866, which is of the same subject matter
and I look forward to a robust conversation at that point. Mr. Chair.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 828 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. And members, before we recess, anything that you do not want to keep, leave it on the table, put your other stuff back in your packet, because we are going to be meeting at 500 South. With that, we are recessed until 7:30 to the call of the chair.
I will reconvene the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee for March 7th. Representative Ackland, you caught a break today because Representative Fulver was supposed to be the first testifier, and Bill, when he came back, he is not here. You promised me that you would show everybody how brevity works tonight with the bill so that the committee could get in and out of this evening. So the weight of the world is on your shoulders.
Can we table Mr. Representative Albright's bill so that he wasn't here?
Nope, you haven't seen that yet, so you can't table it. Representative Ackland, welcome to the committee's room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just give me 1 second. Looks like you're headed to the general register if all goes well tonight. I want to move House File 1689 to get it in front of the committee to be re-referred to the general register. Representative Ackland, you have the election bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope that works. This bill is real basic. It was in last year's tax bill, and what it does, Mr. Chair, members, is it allows cities or towns to donate to their local town historical society rather than have to go through the county. And some of them, I believe, had been doing it until they found out that they couldn't. They used $90, and so it just changes a little bit of wording, and a lot of those townships and towns in my district are real proud of their local historical society. So that's the extent of my bill, Mr. Chair.
Very good, Representative Ackland. Members, questions for Representative Ackland? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1689. Seeing none, hearing none, I will re-renew my motion that House File 1689 be referred to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Very good. Representative Ackland, you did show how brevity works tonight. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Representative Traskowski, we are going to take you next. We're going to just keep moving until we don't have people to move bills for anymore tonight. Representative Traskowski, did you want to do House File 1030 first?
Please, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, we will take up House File 1030. Just give me a moment to get that bill. And with that, Representative Draskowski, I will move House File 1030 before the committee to be re-referred to the state government finance. Representative Draskowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's also an A1 amendment. Mr. Chair, can we move that as well?
Representative Draskowski, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 1030. And members, discussion on House File, the A1 amendment to House File 1030. Get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Representative Draskowski, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1030, the issue is brought to me by Mr. Vries, who is here with us tonight. What it does is gives an individual who doesn't need or want to have insurance coverage under the state insurance plan, who is a state employee, suggests, or it actually would say that they would not have to have the insurance, they could opt out, and that the agency would have to provide a form for them to do so.
Mr. Bruce, welcome to the committee. We'll ask you to state your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brent Ruiz. I am a state employee. Pardon my voice, I'm just getting a little cold.
You and a lot of other Minnesotans these days.
I am also a retired and disabled veteran, so I get 100% medical care through the VA. And I am not allowed to opt out of the state of Minnesota's insurance, and they won't pay the VA. So the costs to the state and the agency I work for and myself are waste. So there is currently two different tax entities that are paying for insurance on me, and I consider them both to be Cadillac plans, according to the vernacular out there today, and the current bill does allow for specific language for legislators to opt out of the insurance, and that is it. This bill would simply bring parity to everyone else who qualifies for this insurance to be able to opt out of it if they have a better plan. And I have discussed this with other employees who are veterans and reservists who potentially would want to use TRICARE or are using the brief enough for you.
Very good, sir. Very good. It does seem to me that you do have two different sources of coverage, and you have to have the one. You have the benefit from the other, from your service to the country, which we do appreciate. And it seems like it might be those dollars may be better used elsewhere. And so with that, I'll open it up to member questions, if there are any. Representative Nelson.
Sure, and I didn't catch the gentleman's name, but Representative Duskowski, my understanding of this, and it's not the deepest in that, but this would lower the pool. It would increase the cost for all other state employees because the shrinking of the pool, and that's how insurance works. Have we thought about that possibility, or have we looked into that?
Are you asking the bill author that question? Or
yes.
Okay. Representative Duskowski to Representative Nelson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I have not read in the process, and we certainly have some sort of fiscal or revenue note around this impact to the insurance or whatever we would put together for some analysis around that. But the focus is not on the health of the insurance pool or anything else. The focus is on what is right for state employees who don't want or need insurance because they can get it somewhere else. And specifically, Mr. Vries's coverage under TRICARE and has been unable to, as he's asked multiple times in many different places. I've got an email chain that he shared with me. He's been unable to simply opt out like we legislators have the ability to opt out of the state health care plan. So it's not focusing at all on the health or non-health of the insurance pool, but it's focusing on what is right and healthy for the employee going forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Duskowski, the reason why I'm asking about the pool is if the insurance pool decreases and increases the cost for all other state employees, that increases the cost for the state of Minnesota. And so this could have a huge impact on our budget to help maybe one or two or three people. And that's why I'm asking the question. I just want to make sure that we're not doing something here that would increase our state costs and make our budget on health care coverage for all of our other state employees. Mr. Chair, the other question I have has to do with most people I've talked to that have insurance that if each year they're asked, do you have the availability, and we get that same letter, for other coverage to make sure that you're covered elsewhere so they can do the group coverage piece of it so that each insurance company is only paying a portion of it. So could this, if he answers that no, I don't have the availability for other coverage because he's opt out of it, could that cause issues with his other insurance and other insurances as well? And I don't know. I'm asking a question that is something we need to think about. Representative Duskowski or whoever.
I don't know if we have the answer to it, but we will go to Representative Duskowski to give it his best shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I really fully understood the question, but in terms of what the impact would be to the CDIP fund, I think we'll find that out when we get to the Finance Committee.
There is a fiscal amount. This is going to state government finance, so that particular question might be the better answer for the dollars and cents in that committee. Representative Nelson, just again to the A1 amendment, this is something I spoke with Representative Duskowski about, and he also agreed that this would be important, that we wouldn't have employees just opting out because they do need coverage, but they would also have to provide proof before they could opt out. They are covered elsewhere. Representative Joaquin, Representative Nelson.
And Representative Chair Driscoll, that is a good amendment. I can
said, I just have concerns and thoughts, and like I said, I'm just looking at this and just want to make sure that to fix this gentleman's problem, which I understand, I fully understand it, and I know as a legislature we can opt out, but we have to have other coverage. And I know I did that a couple of terms when I had my outside employment because it actually saved the state money by us renewing it, then not having to pay insurance on me. Just want to make sure that we cover all our bases to make sure we're not, to fix one problem, we're not creating 10 or 15 other ones, and that's my only concern, that we're not adding cost to the state.
Very good. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just actually have a good question. Would the employees still be able to be in an HSA, like a house savings account, a pre-tax dollar one? I know it's not always linked with whatever health coverage you have, but it just seems to be like if you don't want to have this, you shouldn't have that either. Just curious.
Before I turn it over, remember, folks, even though it's after 5 o'clock, we still have to have recording, so if you move the mics towards you, that'll be helpful. For everybody's purposes. Representative Draskowski, or who is going to take that question? I think I have a partial answer for that, but I'll go with the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, I can answer that question. The health care savings account is not involved with the insurance, and I was allowed to opt out of that.
Thank you.
In the state of Minnesota, under CGAP, has two different options. One, a copay, the second, an HSA option on there. And then there's also a flexible spending account. My assumption would be the employee would still be eligible for the flexible spending account, but because they didn't have coverage that met the high deductible requirement, they would not be eligible for the HSA-type coverage. Other member questions at this time? Anyone from the public that wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1030 has amended. Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Draskowski, I will renew my motion for House File 1030 as amended to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Before we get to the second bill, what Representative Draskowski has, we do have a piece of housekeeping that we need to do. A bill that is still in our possession, which was the Representative Vogel bill, 1146, from last Friday, if I'm not mistaken. I'll ask staff for some help on that. We've sent it to the General Register. We want to take it and refer it to taxes for a hearing in the Tax Committee before it moves to the General Register. And Representative Nelson, I will ask if you have a problem with that on your caucus.
We're
still in our possession. We're just going to make a motion to reconsider and then re-refer to taxes.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem with that. I think if you remember that bill, I think I asked that question when they were referring it because they had my left tax applications. But
the nature of it is a biannual notice and referendum provided for municipalities on utility licensing.
Okay.
Maybe a week before.
Yeah, that could be wrong, yes. Which has a number of bills.
Yeah, we referred that one too based on the fines. We kept that in our possession because we found out about that. We're trying to move bills as fast as we can in the session, and we were caught this one, kept it in possession. And staff reminded me this morning that I didn't do it at that time, and they wanted to make sure we got it done this evening. So if there isn't any concerns, I will move to reconsider House File 1146, bring it back before the committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And now I will make a motion to re-refer House File 1146, and if it was amended, as amended, that will work, to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you. Now, Representative Draskowski, your second and final bill, House File 654, I will bring that to for the committee to be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Chair Draskowski, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, this bill in its entirety was a portion of House File 848 in 2015, part of the House Omnibus Tax Bill. Two major bills that really are in here. One is a collection of special elections throughout statute that we attempted in 2015 to identify and organize all of the special elections in statute related to cities, counties, schools, and townships that we could to move them to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of either year, either the odd year or the even year, in terms of an election or a ballot measure. We narrowed down and actually pruned out a handful of them that didn't make sense, that didn't work for various reasons, and don't ask me which ones they were or why, but there were reasons that some of them we were unable to move, and so they are not part of this bill and they're not part of House File 848 in 2015. Also in here is a series of sections dealing with what has been labeled the Property Taxpayer Empowerment Act. And what that provides is that it's a protection that the taxpayers will be empowered in situations where a certified levy by a unit of government does not include schools but includes cities and counties. If in their December certified levy the local government provides a levy that's higher than the levy from the previous year, the taxpayers at that point would have the option to, if that circumstance occurs, would have the option to collect a number of petitions of 10% of the voters from the last election from that jurisdiction. They would be able to form out a petition to place the issue on the November ballot of the following, or of that following year, which is the certification of the following November. And if indeed that referendum falls in favor of the taxpayers that form out and certify the petition, then the local unit government would be in a position to have to place the levy back to the point that it was the prior year before that certification happened. So that's the bill, those two components, if you will, Mr. Chair and members. There is one place in here, and I don't have an amendment, Mr. Chair, but I've made a commitment to the Association of Townships, and that is in Section 3 of the bill on page 5, line 5.23 or thereabouts. I worked with Ms. Dyson to form out the language. We wanted to place in there the ability for them to also address these questions at an annual election of the township as well. So it was an oversight when we put the bill together originally. So we will add that, Mr. Chair, in the next committee. That's a new complete section, if you will.
And Representative Draskowski, does that complete your overview of the bills this evening? Very good. Any initial member questions at this time? Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, would this increase the number of elections townships and cities and counties would have to hold if there were referendums? If there was enough referendums filed, I mean, would they have to hold more elections and increase costs to the cities and townships and counties?
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson. No, Representative Nelson, actually it's exactly the opposite. Instead of having to hold a special election on May 13th or April 2nd, where they would have to pay for the poll workers and all the costs associated with an election, the election would coincide either with a general election on the first Tuesday in November, or a special election in this jurisdiction on the first Tuesday in November. So in half of the years for sure they would avoid an election and just simply use the existing general election in that jurisdiction. So I think there'd be significant savings to over time to local governments throughout Minnesota.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Gruskowski, so in years where they have a general election, they would have, it would fall in the general election. But if they, in the year that there isn't a general election, they'd be adding an election for in November for themselves and not having a special election. But if they're not, if say they have the normal city elections in the complar line up with the general elections, in the even number of years there would be no extra cost, but in the odd number of years when they normally don't, there would be additional cost.
Chair Gruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson. In the event they didn't have another election going on in their jurisdiction on the odd year, I've got that right, Ms. Tyson, on the odd year, it would have to be a special election, but they would have a special election whether it was on November, first Tuesday in November or April 17th.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, this confusion about when they would have, there's a bill we'll be hopefully hearing in not too long that would offer a set of four dates each year to try and unify when we would have special elections so we could have people ready and also minimize multiple special elections if they could be bundled. So I like the idea, and hopefully we can improve upon it. Thank you.
Sounds like a bill author. Marketing is built for it.
Kitchen.
Representative Eugene.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know if you were going to go to testimony or go right to questions.
We'll go to the initial questions, and then we'll bring folks in. I just want to make sure that member. Okay. I'll put you on the list. Seeing no other member questions at this time, I do have four testifiers that have asked to testify this evening, and we will go with those, and certainly any members of the public or others here who would like to testify in the manner will have a chance to do that. The four individuals that I have in the order that I will ask them to come forward, Mr. Sky Kuhnquist, Ms. Val Gosselin, and then Mark Hilbert, and Gary Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kuhnquist is not available to come back tonight.
So we will then go to you. Welcome to the committee, state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Joseland. I am doing triple duty tonight. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and then I'm also speaking for on behalf of Scott Kuhnquist from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And just I want to raise concerns to Section 4 of the bill, which would only limit school district special elections to one day a year. Right now, school districts choose to hold their special elections, and mainly we're talking about bond elections for school construction projects. I'll try to focus just on the kind of election-related provisions, although we do believe that this proposal will delay school construction projects and could also potentially increase the cost to local taxpayers. But I just some things I've heard about in the past about this issue was that school districts sometimes hold elections in odd times of the year because they think they'll get a better outcome for their election. Our data that I've looked into shows that school district bond elections have the same chance of passing in the spring as they do in November. In 2015, there were 27 special elections for school district bond referendums. 13 failed. In the spring, there were 44 on the general election day. There were 44 general bond elections, and 20 failed. In 2016, there were 24 special elections, 18 failed. And then in 2016, in the general election, there were 11 bond referendums on the ballot, and 7 failed. So this kind of idea that school districts are trying to hold elections, and certainly I don't ascribe that to Representative Dreskowski. I didn't hear that today, but that those are some comments I've heard in the past. This idea that school districts are holding elections outside of the general election to try to have a better success of passing is not the case. The reason why bond referendums happen in the spring is the timing of construction projects. There's usually an 18-month window for construction projects, and the elections happening in the spring allows for construction projects to be ready for the following school year. I also want to just point out in regards to, while special elections might have lower voter turnout, the attention on special elections is much greater. Generally, school district elections and general elections don't get a lot of notice. School districts are competing with the presidential election race, the governor's race, or whatever statewide office. And often in a special election, it's the only election on the ballot. And generally, there's much more attention focused on that election. And it allows the school districts to make their case in a much clearer light for voters. And then, as I mentioned, we do have some questions about the delay in timing and the potential cost to taxpayers as a result of delay in school construction projects. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Seeing no number of questions, you may want to stick by because there may be something coming up. Mr. Hibbert and then Mr. Carlson, and then if there's anyone from the public or anyone else who'd like to testify, see James, he's got the list. I'll have you sign in and we'll get you in queue here tonight. Mr. Hibbert, welcome. Identify yourself for the record, state who you're with, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgarts. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all Minnesota's 87 counties. I want to thank Representative Draskowski, not necessarily for bringing the bill forward, but for the honor and privilege of at least coming in front of our members 2 years ago and talking to them about this. And I thought it was very noble of him to do so. I thought we had a very good discussion at our legislative conference. The one point that our commissioners brought forward was that they did not feel that this was necessary. First and foremost, because of the transparency and opportunity that the public already has to be invested in the county process, the budgeting process, the levying process. As you know, many of our counties have bi-weekly or monthly meetings that are all public meetings. There are robust publication notice requirements that the legislature has put on counties and cities to notify the public of meetings, to publish our budget documents every year, to budget our proposed levy certifications and a final levy as well. There's also a separate truth and taxation process that citizens can be involved in. And last but not least, as one editorial writer wrote, the most important referendum of all, which is the election process. I'd end just by noting on some of the complexities that might not be addressed by this current version. We'd be happy to work with Representative Draskowski to perhaps touch on these, but as you know, counties are responsible for administering several mandates in regards to health and human services. And that's kind of that invisible layer of county government or government that folks don't necessarily associate with counties, but does happen. That is the unfortunate situation surrounding child protection, things like that. Those are not budgetable costs. You talk to any county commissioner in your districts, and those aren't things that they can budget from year to year. In certain counties in the north, ICWA costs, child protection costs, are a significant part of their budget. And if the situations were to change, we don't know how that would actually interplay with what is written in this proposal. But again, we'd be happy to work with Representative Draskowski if he's interested in talking about that. So thank you, and thank you for your time.
Mr. Miller, thank you. I don't see any questions, so we'll go to Mr. Carlson. And again, if there's anyone else who'd like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 654, please see James. He'll get you in queue here this evening. Mr. Carlson, welcome. State your name and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to state that this is a large bill, and most of the bill, as Representative Draskowski indicated, deals with moving elections to the general election. I vetted that with our city officials, and cities don't regularly hold elections on fiscal issues outside of the general election, so it wasn't a big issue for us to do that. However, changing all those special or general election requirements would remove some flexibility if something were to arise. To that end, Representative Draskowski last year did add a provision that would allow us in the event of a disaster or an emergency to basically have an election to issue debt to cover such costs. So he did accommodate us, I guess it was 2 years ago that he accommodated us on that. The real issue that we have with this bill is in Section 10 on page 13 of the bill. That's the Taxpayer Empowerment Act, I think is how it's described. Basically, this would create a new process that cities and counties would have to follow. And for those of you who have served on the city council or have been a mayor or a council member,
you know that basically you go through a fairly long budget setting process. This would overlay another process on that, and basically if you use the example of this year, if this coming December a city were to raise its levy over the 2017 levy amount, that would allow voters to trigger a potential referendum through a petition. The referendum or that petition would have to be filed by next June, and the election would be held by November of 2018. Now that's on a levy increase that effectively has already been paid by all of the taxpayers. So the election would occur well after the event that instigated the referendum, and the vote would actually be on the levy that's being set for the following year. So this would possibly create some confusion among taxpayers as they are about to get their truth in taxation notices based on a proposed levy. This could actually revert that back to the 2017 levy amount in that depiction that I gave you. A couple of things to think about also. As I read the bill, there are no special levies outside of levy limits for things like judgments or emergencies or disasters that could cause a levy to rise. Typically, under levy limits, we've had carve-outs for special levies to allow cities to levy above and beyond any state-imposed levy. There is a prohibition on new debt issued from June to November should there be a trigger of a referendum by the voters. And then finally, one thing to think about. Whenever you pass a law, you do create incentives or disincentives or perverse incentives for actions to occur. And I'm just looking at the levies that were proposed, actually certified by cities this year. There were 61 cities that actually cut their property tax levy. That's about 8% of our cities. If you create incentives so that you might have to raise, well, if you were to raise the levy in the subsequent year, even up back to the level that it was prior to the reduction this year, you could trigger a petition from the voters in a referendum. So you might create a situation where cities decide, well, we're not going to cut the levy because we don't want to ultimately trigger a referendum just to simply go back to where we were. So think about those incentives that might be created when you do create these new laws. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Mr. Carlson, I don't see any member questions at this time, but we'll ask you to stand by. Is there anyone from the public or anyone here this evening that would like to provide testimony on House File 654, which is before the committee? Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski, I had the pleasure of seeing this bill 2 years ago, and it's bringing back some memories, but I just wanted to clarify them. On 13.21, is there a reason why you exempted cities under 500?
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I'm trying to remember.
It's the same language as last time, though. I can tell you that.
I think the last time we talked about this, I kind of made a comment of like a city councils in cities of 500 smarter than cities over 500, and you said that you can get everybody in the same room to talk about. I'm still having the same concerns about exempting cities under 500, because if it's good for them, it should be good for everybody. And then also, why the 13.1 and 14.2, voters equal number to 10% of the votes cast in the last general election. Now, we recently had a bill through that said 10% of the registered voters, which gave me a little bit more comfort. Why 10% of those that cast ballots in the last election?
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, we borrowed this language from other places in statute. I'd certainly be willing to talk to you about that if you think that that's a better approach. I haven't really analyzed it. I think the greater discussion is around the number, whether it's 10% or 5 or 15 or 20, and I think all of those numbers appear in different parts of statute for different types of referendums. So I'd be willing to talk to you about that and feel strongly about it, but I really don't have any other comments on that.
Is it you, King Fowler?
Chair, thank you, Representative Draskowski. So when I look back at the numbers and the elections in Hopkins, 1 year it was 879 people. So it'd be 80 folks in a population of over 18,000 that could then trigger a referendum, and I personally could go to any one of the farmer's market or multi-unit housing and talk 80 people into signing just about anything. So that concerns me a little bit, that the lower threshold really does And just, I think, Mr. Carlson did a good job of explaining some of the other concerns that we have with changing a levy that's been already paid and passed due the year before and putting it on the next election cycle. And when he said about creating incentives to keep your levies high, some cities around us, Hopkins wasn't one of them, but other cities did when we had levy caps, had those real discussions about whether or not we wanted to lower our levies because we could be stuck underneath that cap then. And people were raising their levies up to the cap just in case. And that's not good public policy either. So sometimes when we do these things, we create weird incentives that we don't realize. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this in property taxes again. So I'll save my questions for then.
Chair Draskowski, follow-up from...
I think we'll discuss all those in property. We'll cuss and discuss the property taxes for sure, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other member questions at this time? Oh, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
how old are your special guest tonight?
Thank you. He's busy with a book under the table. So he highly recommends Chris Colfer's Land of Stories series if anyone's looking for a good read. I just wanted to say ponder this a little bit more because I think, Representative Draskowski, what you're asking us to consider is fundamentally changing the way our local governments govern. Changing it from a republic like we govern at the state level where you elect people to represent you and to make decisions based on the community interest, and then the public gets to decide yes or no if you're doing what the public wanted you to do. And that's why our local elected officials stand for re-election and why they answer to the voters. You're wanting to change this to a direct democracy. We see a lot more of that in California than we do in Minnesota, and it tends to lead to a lot of chaos. I think as we look over to the West Coast, and I come from a city that is well managed, and we have a very high voter turnout. Our citizens are very active and engaged, and to say that somehow we should change the way that our government functions fundamentally doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm not going to support this because of the additional cost, and also because, as I said, it really changes the way that we govern in the state of Minnesota. And I think that the public has a lot of opportunities to be informed and weigh in, and they do, and I'm pleased that they do. I run this full tonight on a lovely evening. But we can't change the way that we fundamentally govern, and that's what this does. You can say that it's about more voter participation, but it's not. The voters have a say in whether or not they're being represented appropriately. So to change government from a republic to a direct democracy, to me, fundamentally changes the way that we have built our governmental systems in Minnesota and across the country, and I have a lot of concern with it. So I'm going to oppose you, Bill.
Chair Draskowski, follow-up?
Didn't have a question, Mr. Chair.
Just giving you a chance to respond, as we do with all testifiers and authors. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment. Again, this seems like another attack on local government. But more importantly, I think it really makes it very, very difficult for any city to have stability in whatever they do. I mean, you're changing things from year to year. And usually when we're making plans, we're going out more than a year.
Chair Draskowski.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll maybe just respond to them collectively, those comments. And the other option for us in the tax area, and Mr. Carlson talked about, has been used in the past extensively, is levy limits. And local governments don't like that either. And this, I think, is an innovative approach that
isn't something that the light is always turned on. I think actually the light would be turned on this very rarely, and only in those situations where local government was not in good communication and in good regard with their citizenry. I don't know how to, you know, really address those concerns. This empowers the people in situations where their government just fails to listen. And we've seen that, and I'm sure we've all seen that in one or more of our communities at one time or another. But the vast majority of the times, I think that the local units of government are well in communication and well in discussion with their citizenry, and in those cases, even if there was a 1 or 3 or 4% increase, if it was legitimate and the local unit of government was doing a good job of communicating with their people and going through processes that brought legitimacy to their actions, you probably wouldn't see the petition come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That reminds me of one other question. Have you thought about adding percentage increase instead of saying any amount over? Because at this, the way it reads right now, it could be $1 more than you levy from the year before.
Chair Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Viola Kim, I have, and we may think of that down the road, but as Governor Dayton does such a great job of, I want to start from the strongest position.
Any other member questions? Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Drozdowski, I appreciate that you're willing to work with the stakeholders and would encourage you to continue to do so. I have heard from some of my cities, and they would ask you to continue doing so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, seeing no other testimony or other member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 654 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Representative Drozdowski, you are on your way this evening, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
The next bill we'll have on the agenda is House File 1866, and excuse me, we'll have the bill's author, Representative Albright, come to the testifier table. And Representative Albright, before we begin this evening, this is one of the bills that not everything in this bill is specifically within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. The things that we will be looking at would be those areas that would affect the oversight of the subject of the bill and the like. And so we are not here to weigh in on the subject matter of light rail. We are here to weigh in on the governance, if you will, and the structure issues that surround the bill. And so, Ms. Dyson, I'm going to give you an opportunity before we start hearing from the bill's author to just kind of have members give a clear idea of what we're looking at. I probably didn't do it justice. But before I do that, I'm just going to bring it officially before the committee. So I will move House File 1866 to be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. And with that, Ms. Dyson, I'd ask you to give a little bit more articulate just directions to what we'll be looking at within the purview of this committee. Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the entire bill deals with the Metropolitan Council. The first two sections dealing with regional rail authority and county or city, that has to do with light rail project development and the authority of local governments to engage in that. Section 3 is the bulk of the bill that deals with the governance structure that was also in House File 828 that was presented earlier today.
That's a lifetime ago, Mr. Chair.
In Section 4 is the Metropolitan Council's budget and the legislature's oversight and control of the budget. And then the the Section 5 is Metropolitan Council's the legislative direction to the council to have a fare box recovery on its transits, on its bus, on its transit lines, and pretty much all of it is Metropolitan Council's powers and duties. There is, again, in sections 8, 9, and 10, you have more on council's role with regard to development and location of light rail transit. And then section 11, actually, it's, I think Representative Barr earlier today referred to that section when he was presenting his bill on Oak Grove, and this is the language that he has that's related to that provision. And then some conforming amendments. Pretty much the whole thing is Metropolitan Council.
Yeah, we're not necessarily talking about the topic. It's more the governance issue. And Representative Albright, I want to tell you that I think your eyesight has improved since this morning's committee. When you refer to me as Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Those who are at the morning meeting on the Senate, we're talking about it. With that, Representative Albright, we'll give you the opportunity to present the bill. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and members, good evening. As I said, we've come a long way since this morning, and it's good to see you again. This is not a topic that for many of us in the room that we are unknowledgeable about, so I will be brief because I know the hour's late, and we have a number of other things that we would much prefer to do. But nonetheless, this is an important topic, and so it does obligate us to take serious consideration of the bill itself. For many, many years, the Metropolitan Council has done yeoman service with regard to its fundamental responsibilities as it was originally intended to do with regard to wastewater treatment and sewer. But unfortunately, along the way, our established legislatures over the course of the last 50 years since the Citizens League helped form it, we have abdicated our role and responsibility in terms of decisions that ultimately have landed in the lap of the Met Council. That being said, it has grown, without question. What we are here tonight to discuss is the governance overarching all of those responsibilities underlying the Met Council. We believe it is in the best interests of the people that they serve to have an elected body of representatives of the municipalities and counties or townships that would be represented by the decision-making process appointed to the Met Council. There are a number of other provisions within 1866. You can debate those as you wish, but germane to the conversation tonight is the governance structure of the Met Council. I know that there are a couple of amendments. We can certainly take those in the order and debate those. But with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time tonight, and I will leave you with a topic that while we have all heard it, and there are a number of people sitting behind me that would greatly desire to participate in the conversation, I would encourage everyone, not because of the lateness of the hour, but to be succinct in the comments so that we do not overlap. And if anything is said that has been said, we probably don't need to deliver the point again. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Well stated, Representative Albright. We do want to hear from people, but if thoughts are similar to what others have said, we can dispense with those and share new thoughts for the committee as they deliberate. With that, I have four individuals who have asked to testify on the bill, and I'm going to call the first two up, and Mayor Mark Korn and Mayor Bob Crawford, if you want to come forward, and we'll have you both at the testifier's table here, and save ourselves some time in having folks walk up from the back. And then following that will be Ms. Nauman and Mr. Keith Carlson. With that, good evening, Mayor. We'll start with the Mayor from Oak Grove. You're kind of a regular here today. I don't know what else you could share with us after we've heard from you, but I bet you got a few other thoughts to share with us.
Well, I do, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Introduce yourself, if you will, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mark Corrin, Mayor for the City of Oak Grove, Minnesota. I've had the opportunity to speak on behalf of the citizens of Oak Grove, but I'm really here, and when I prepared for speaking on this topic in itself, I had a number of mayors and city council members that had specifically asked me to tell you, committee members, that they wish that they could come here and say exactly what our thoughts are, is that this bill needs to get passed because there does need to be changes in the way the relationship between our views, our elected views, our election certificate is the representation of our citizens. And I'm going to pretty much just say, I believe that this bill is the first step that needs to get done. It's taken a long time, but it should have happened a long time ago.
Thank you, Mayor, for your comments. And we'll go to the next mayor, Mayor Crawford. Welcome. State your name for the record. Who do you represent? Proceed with your testimony.
I'm Bob Crawford. I'm the mayor of Elkhorn Newmarket. Before, I just said it was choice for elected officials if they chose to have time for my council. I know there's a lot of mayors from larger cities that are serving on a lot more committees than I would, because they're bigger cities. But if they chose to be on the council, they'd have to give up some of those committees. So, I mean, it is a matter of choice of where they decide they're going to put their time. I mean, I think the Met Council is important enough that some of them may choose if there was that opportunity. They may not want to choose because they like what they're doing, but that's the biggest part. And I feel the Met Council is probably something that Representative Walverson said earlier. It's not a representative form of government. It's a committee of a dictator. Whichever governor is there chooses it, and they do what he says. And so the metro area is held hostage to the governor. So that's all I have to say.
Mayors, thank you for your time. Ms. Gallman, we'll have you come forward with Mr. Keith Carlson, and then Commissioner Gerlach, you are next. Ms. Gallman, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing 90 cities in the metropolitan area. I did testify this morning on House File 828, so I will just be very brief here. The points I just would ask you to think about. Metro Cities does oppose House File 1866 with respect to the governance of the Metropolitan Council and remaking that to a local official model. For the reasons I testified to this morning, which address largely the inherent conflicts of interest and divided loyalties that would be confronting local officials under this model that we believe would be baked into the structure and not advisable for the legislature to undertake for the Metropolitan Council's governance or governance of another entity. Metro Cities does support staggered terms and improvements to the processes for selecting Metropolitan Council members to improve transparency and accountability in those processes, and staggered terms, which we believe would stabilize ideological shifts on the council and provide for continuity of knowledge in the council. I also just want to add that the organization does oppose prohibiting local spending to study or design or construct light rail transit or any other kind of transit in the region. We believe those are local decisions that have go through lengthy public processes, and we would oppose that provision in the bill. Metro Cities finally would oppose eliminating the Transportation Advisory Board. This is a 34-member board that does have participation by not just local officials, but state agencies, the Metropolitan Council, and citizens. We think it's a process that does encompass, allow for the input by many voices, and we would oppose eliminating that body, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Nauman, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson, and then Commissioner Gerlach. If there's anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before us this evening, again, see James. He'll get you signed in and get you in queue. James, Executive Director from the Met Council, would like to speak as well. Mr. Carlson, welcome. State your name for the record, who you represent. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that has four suburban members in our association. Three of those members, Scott County, Carver County, Dakota County, all support particularly Section 3 of this bill. Our organization has adopted legislative recommendations or a platform this first session that has a section specific to metropolitan governance that basically comports to the changes made in Section 3. And I want to address several issues that have been raised by the opponents of this bill. First, with regards to the composition of the council, has representatives of or members of local government. That model, the council of governments model, is used widely throughout the United States. It's a successful model in the many regions that uses it, and I frankly see no reason why that cannot be successful here. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, specifically to address the many concerns that local governments do have with the roles that the council performs secondly. I do want to make it clear this makes no change in the council's current role of being a planning agency, Met Transit operator of the metropolitan waste control operations, or, very important to local governments, distributor of tens of millions of dollars of federal transportation aid every year. With regards to concerns about this changing how the diverse population within the metropolitan area would be represented, I want to make it clear that 16 of the 23 members who would vote on all issues before the council would be apportioned by population. 11 of those represent essentially the counties, cities within the 694-494 ring. Add to those the two representatives from Hennepin and Ramsey County that effectively have a majority of 13 of the 23 seats. Will not change substantially. The quorum or vote does change with regards to the allocation of federal transportation aid by the addition of four members selected by the Commissioner of Transportation. So then the total quorum becomes 27 at that point. With the four members selected by the Commissioner of Transportation, plus the 13 that I just went through, again, they have a substantial majority of 17 of the 27 seats. With regards to the issues of conflicts and ability to serve, obviously the municipal entities that will be selecting the city representatives for each of the 16 districts will take into consideration the ability of the individual to serve. And so I don't think there's an issue there. The members should know that basically the Met Council meets during the daytime, city councils meet during the evening. With regards to conflicts or failing to represent the district, again, these districts are apportioned on population, just as the representatives of those districts should hopefully be reflecting the interests of their discrete geographic interests right now. These new representatives, as the council is recomposed, would obviously have the same interests. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I think we do have a question. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, could you repeat again the three counties that you represent for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joaquin, Carver, Scott, and Dakota counties are all supporters of the recomposition of the council as represented in Section 3 of this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
You mentioned proportionality of the other current Met Council seats, and they are divided by population. Can you tell me the population of your three counties?
Madam, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I cannot tell you the exact population. I know the issue that you're driving at, that the population of those two, three counties are significantly below Hennepin and Ramsey County. But again, the areas inside the 694-394 ring have a functioning majority within the newly constituted council.
Your looking follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that is the concern, is the proportionality. The bigger the vote equals, Dakota County is 167,000, Hennepin's 1.2 million, yet their votes would be the same. So that is a concern. And I know you mentioned councils of governance models in other states when it comes to, I believe those are only with most of them are with revolving around transportation only, not all the other aspects that the government council does. Is that correct?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joachim, it varies from metropolitan area to metropolitan area.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson, or to the author. Let me make sure I get this right. We've got other MPOs, or Metropolitan Planning Organizations, in the state, and what are the approaches with them as it relates to elected officials on those bodies?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, essentially they are local government officials with also the participation of representatives of the Department of Transportation.
Representative Nash, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to date, with those, no problems as far as you can ascertain as it relates to the possible change of what we're doing?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, no, I don't believe there have been any issues that they have adequately represented the jurisdictions that they represent.
Seeing all the involved, do you have Representative Joachim wants to give
up? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, to what something Representative Nash said, I know there's a few other MPOs in the state. Do any of those other MPOs also pay a salary to the members that are on their MPOs as well as the city councils paying them a salary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry. No, to my knowledge, they do not.
So, Mr. Chair, that's another concern, too, is that they're getting paid by two different folks. So that's a little conflict to me. Thank you.
Question or comment? Representative Joachim, is there a question or just a comment on that? All right. Mr. Carlson, thank you. Commissioner Gerlach, and then we'll be having Executive Director Judge Shelton. You are up after Representative, former legislator, and now County Commissioner Gerlach. And again, if there's anyone else who would like to testify on the matter, we're happy to hear from you. Just connect with James, and he'll get you queued in and get you in line to be testifying. Mr. Gerlach, welcome. State your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Chris Gerlach. I'm from Apple Valley. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner, and I am representing the full backing of my full county board, as well as participating with three other counties, Anoka, Carver, and Scott, and also numerous city officials, city council members, and mayors that helps to develop language and make contributions to Section 3 of this bill. So I'm here to strongly support that, and I wanted to give you a couple of things to think about. Now, several of you have heard me in other committees, and I've been here in past years as well, and so you know that I have zeroed in, or so our group has zeroed in on what we believe the key problem is for the future governance of the Met Council, and that is the governance structure. There'll be time enough to dig into the scope and the mission and all of those other side issues, but we figure if we get the governance structure right, the rest will come later. A year ago, we developed some principles that we thought would bring more democracy and more of a bottom-up rather than top-down process to the Met Council. This year, we've actually put language together in a bill, so thank you for Representative Albright for carrying that language here. The problem as we see it is that the Met Council is run as a state agency from the top down. It is not truly regional governance. It has a constituent, everybody on the Met Council has a constituency of one, not a broad-based democratic constituency as all of us who are elected have. And we believe that that leads to a very narrow political agenda that goes back and forth depending on the effects or the result of the statewide election. We want to give the Met Council the political legitimacy that it deserves and should have from all local governments, and that is derived from participation and feeling that you have a voice in the proceedings of what's going on. There have been several arguments against that, and I'm going to hit those, and then I'll be done. The first one is you'll hear that members can't think regionally if they come from a grassroots constituency rather than appointed by the governor, but they're too parochial. And I would say, so what? It's a democratic process. All of you represent districts. You come together, you debate, you argue about issues, and at the end of the day, you have a vote, and then you move on. That's how the Met Council would operate. You have a true debate on issues rather than everybody just having a group think, essentially, or having the governor pick up a telephone and call the chair, who is really a cabinet-level appointee, who is effectively the commissioner of the Department of Metropolitan Affairs. That's how it operates, and it shouldn't be that way. I would say that we should embrace the democratic process, although it can be messy, it can be chaotic. It's a wonderful thing, and we shouldn't fear it. We should embrace it. You hear about time commitment, that there's no way you could do both jobs. Well, with all the cities we have in the metro area, there's probably over 1,000 individuals that could serve in this capacity. Probably over 1,000. This bill calls for 16. I think we could find 16 people that would have the capacity, the ability, the willingness to serve in this additional capacity. So to use a blanket statement by saying that there's no way any city council members or mayors would be able to do this, I think sells short hundreds and hundreds of individuals. You hear that there's conflicts of interest. We have all sorts of joint powers groups and all sorts of different boards and commissions that local government officials serve on today. I know that the county, we have the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board that makes all sorts of big decisions that affects the entire metro area. The Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, the Mosquito Control District. I serve on the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority Board, which covers multiple counties and lots of municipal jurisdictions. And we figure it all out, and we represent the whole area that we have jurisdiction over. I've brought up several times about the proportionality and the votes. What I would say is, let's not fixate exactly on the details. If it's not right, I bet you the authors are wide open to amendments to adjust the number of people here, or the terms, or the compensation, or whatever it might be, because the central importance of Section 3 of this bill has to do with the appointing authority, and it has to do with the constituency and who we're answerable to. I believe the Met Council is accountable. You hear oftentimes that, well, they're not accountable. I believe they are. The problem is, to whom are they accountable? A broad-based constituency, as they should be in a democratic process, or simply just to one person, which is a narrow, top-down process, and that's not going to serve us well for the future. Thank you.
Commissioner Gerlach, thank you. I don't see any member questions, and so, Mr. Jettman, we'll have you come forward. And again, if there's anyone else who's interested in testifying, Steve James, he'll get you queued in and get you signed in. Good evening and welcome. State your name for the record. Who do you represent? And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jed Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. I did submit some written testimony earlier. We've had a wild day between the House and the Senate related to a number of bills, so my appreciation to Ms. Teasley for taking that and providing that to the members. Just a couple things before I do hop into my presentation. There was a question about the population of particular counties and how they would be represented as far as the membership on the council. And Hennepin County has 1.2 million people. Ramsey County has 533,000. And we'll hop down to Scott County has about 140,000. And Carver County has 98,000. So that just to answer the question that came up earlier related to if there were weighting applied to those county votes that would be potentially put on the council. So with that, related to the governance pieces in this bill that were included in House Law 828, this really is a discussion that I think that has to be had between the legislature and the governor. I will say that the issues related to the conflict of interest are real, and I think Ms. Nauman did a very good job of explaining those. We speak to that in the letter here as well. And so I'll leave you with that, but there are real issues that when
the council has grants that we provide, or if we have comprehensive plans that are being reviewed, there are issues of having a city council member who's then reviewing a another city's comprehensive plan, and there could potentially be a concern there for a conflict, and there's also an issue related to parochialism that could occur when you start looking at how you're going to divide regional dollars. The question also came up related to the MPO functions. I think Representative Nash asked that question. There are a number of MPOs in the state, but what those MPOs do is that all they do is pass the federal money through to their different areas. The council operates much more different than that, where we are the MPO. That is one function of the council, but we also provide the transit service. We also do the transportation planning. We are required to do that through federal law as the MPO, but we also run our wastewater and utility system. We work with the regional park system, and we do the long-range planning in the metropolitan area based on the Land Planning Act, which is a requirement. All these requirements are provided to the council by the state. And you can't draw an apples-to-apples comparison between what is going on with the other MPOs and what the Metropolitan Council's statutory responsibilities are, because they are completely different. And that's what makes the Met Council a little different. So when you look at how there is potential conflicts, you have to look at it in whole cloth versus just looking at the MPO functions. Mr. Chair and members, I will try to be brief here related to the other provisions in this bill. The first provision related to the legislative approval of light rail projects, which is in section 1 and 2. This is these provisions, not only do they take away local control, but in a practical sense, this would stop the Southwest LRT line. Because in there, it says that the Met Council is prohibited from spending any money to study, plan, design, or construct a light rail line. Well, we have a $700 million invitation for bids on the street today for the civil construction package of the Southwest line. And so if this were to become law, we wouldn't be able to construct that line. And we are anticipating that that project is going to create 7,500 jobs. The state is going to have those folks who build the line, we're going to have a payroll between $350 and $400 million. The state's share of this project today is about $44 million. We have 90% of the funds that go into the capital construction of this line are coming from CTIB. It's 30%. 10% comes from the Hennepin County Regional Rail Authority. 50% is coming from our regional partners, our federal partners. And then the remaining balance that we have today, the council is proposing to do these through certificates of participation, or else we believe that Hennepin County, if and when CTIB dissolves, has offered to take over that share. And so, Mr. Chair, we are in a position to put all of these functions into place right now and actually build this line. And so it does a lot more than just stop the city county or the council from being able to plan, design, or construct a light rail line. It actually stops the Southwest line. The next few provisions really relate to the governance piece, which I mentioned a minute ago. But there is a provision in here, Representative Uglin bill, that requires the council to establish a primary objective of increasing the average farebox ratio by 60% by 2022. This ratio far exceeds any farebox system, recovery system in the country. And we talked to Representative Uglin about that and mentioned that to the committee, that that is a massive jump forward from how any other transit system is funded. And I also mentioned this in the committee, but the council is in the process of actually going through a fare increase process. There is a federal program that we have to follow in order to do that, and we've kicked that off. And if you are a Metro member here at the legislature, you would have received an email from Chair Dunick within the past couple of weeks announcing that we were kicking off that project or that process. So I just want to let you know that we actually are beginning that process. But 60% farebox recovery is way out of bounds. With if that were actually to take place, we would not be able to we wouldn't have any riders to actually serve in the system because it would be so expensive. We'd be talking about fares in the $10 to $14 range, and that is just not wouldn't work. Another section of the bill that changes the process that's used when a city wants to challenge a system statement. The change will allow a local government to argue against a portion of the systems plan outside the transparency of the public discussion related to this. This is a provision that really takes out the ability of doing regional planning. It would allow one city with one provision to slow down the process for how we would look at broad regional systems, wastewater, interceptor pipe, whatever we would do at parks, it has to, or at transportation planning. What this would do is it would slow that down considerably just because one city has an issue with that. And there is a process that we have in place that allows that to be worked out either through an administrative law judge or we work that out between ourselves and the city. But that is a major, major concern for the council. We've also have a provision in here that has the council move from a calendar year budget to a fiscal year budget, like much like the state. I'd like to mention to the committee that only about a third of our funds come from the state. Most of the funds that come through the council come through wastewater service fees, fares, through our levies, and we go through the process, since we operate much more like a local government, that we work with cities to begin the process of setting what our municipal wastewater charge would be in order to make sure that cities are able to plan for that as part of their city budget. And for those funds that come through the state, we participate like any other government unit or state agency. We're not a state agency, but for those provisions that come to the council, we come to the legislature and have that debate with the legislature in order to do that. We also have a legislative commission on metropolitan government that is made up of 14 metro area members whose job it is to review the council's levy, budget, both capital and operating, on an annual basis. And what I do as the council's government affairs director is to provide the public draft well in advance of the council adopting anything to make sure that the legislators who are on that commission have an opportunity to weigh in and provide that input back to the council. So maybe a better way to handle this would be to work on that a little bit more, because shifting from a calendar year to a fiscal year would create major, major problems for our municipal and county members. And Mr. Chair, with that, I think I'm just going to stop. The letter speaks for itself, but I would be happy to answer any questions if you want. And again, thank you to Ms. Tinsley for including the letter. I was worried I wasn't going to be able to be here, but I lucked out, I guess.
Supporting the committee today, so
I appreciate that very much.
Don't run away. We have a question from Representative Joaquin for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had this copied to have this discussion around the light rail planning sections, because I think, as the mayor succinctly put it earlier tonight about local control and how important it is, sections 1, 2, and 10, which I do have an amendment to later, or 1, 2, and 8, totally take away local control. They take away not only the ability for a city to, if they chose to build anything for light rail, but to design it, to plan it, or even study it. So it completely takes away the local control from the cities and the counties, not only, and the Met Council, and any railroad authority as well, from even looking at a project and spending any money or time on it. And I asked Mr. Shetland to provide this document. Maybe he can explain it a little bit, but for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of being in the front end of a BRT or an LRT line when it's starting to be discussed at the local level, which happened in our area in Hopkinson St. Louis Park over 15 years ago, it starts at the local level. It starts with the local counties and the cities getting together with an enormous amount of public input to pick a locally preferred alternative. And that can take anywhere from 2 to 4 to 10 years. Not until that is picked and other things are decided and you start doing environmental impact statements does it ever turn over to the Met Council. So you're taking away the ability for a city or county to even enter into any of that. And I have, if the page can hand these out, maybe Mr. Shetland can explain it a little bit more. It's just kind of the timeline of how that process begins.
James.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll jump into this real quick. The handout that Representative Joachim is showing is basically shows how the process that we use in order to move through a potential, creating a potential transitway. And what it really shows on the front end is that this is not the Metropolitan Council that is doing the alternatives analysis or collecting and deciding what the locally preferred alternative would be. This is a process that takes 2 to 4 years for the cities or the counties who are looking for that project. They do that. It is a local decision that is controlled by those local members in order to decide if they want to move forward with a transitway or not. And so what this is doing is usurping that ability in order to allow those local communities to decide if they would like to look at that potential light rail line or if they would not. And so that project gets turned over to the council once a locally preferred alternative has been selected, and then is potentially moved into the federal either New Starts or Small Starts project, which is way more than you want me to get into right now. But it is it's federally recognized as a project, and that is when it is turned over to the council, because we are the regional MPO where those federal dollars would flow through.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Any other questions from members for Mr. Shetland this evening? We'll have you stand by.
Great.
Anyone else from the public wishing to testify? I think we've got through everybody that we were aware of. Seeing none, let's go to amendments. The A7 amendment. Anyone on the A7 amendment? So, again, H1866A7. On once.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Been a long day, multiple committees. This is mine. This is setting up a task force. My brain is just going dead here tonight.
We don't have to hear it.
So I move the A7 amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A7 amendment to House File 1866.
And Mr. Chair, this can whisper in my ear to remind me and wake up my brain cells, is that this is setting a blue ribbon task force similar to what Representative Albright had in his bill last year to look at governance of the council and come forward with recommendations to the legislature.
Representative Albright to the A7 amendment as the author of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill, Representative Nelson. As we said in the transportation reform last Friday, I did offer up the Liberal panel and also with the assistance of Representative Halverson on occasion in the last biennium. However, in looking at what provisions that were brought forward in the OLA report from a number of years ago, with my opinion that exercise from a board and panel would probably elongate the decision-making process of reforming the governance structure of the Met Council, and from what was gleaned and what was provided to us by the yeoman's work by the OLA and Mr. Nolas, I find that we have sufficient cause to move forward with his work as the foundation for our reformation of the Met Council, so I would while being very respectful of Representative Nelson's efforts here, I would not find it necessary.
Other discussion on the A7 amendment. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just really encourage a vote for Representative Nelson's amendment. This current bill has so many bizarre and irresponsible components. It just makes it... It needs help, a lot of help. So again, I'd encourage you to vote for the amendment.
Other discussion on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A7 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Yeah.
Aye. The motion did not prevail. The amendment was not adopted. The A8 amendment.
That's mine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin, to the A8 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A8 amendment on page 1 deletes sections 1 and 2. Section 1 is a prohibition on a regional rail authority from being able to spend any money to study, plan, or design and construct light rails, so stripping away local control at the regional rail authority level. Section 2 deletes the section that not only doesn't allow the metropolitan, any county or city to start that locally preferred alternative process.
I was looking at the A8 amendment. I have lines 1 through 5, and I'm not seeing the different sections. And
on page 1, delete section 1 and 2.
Okay, I got you. I'm following you. Okay.
Sorry. So 2 is the section that prohibits a county or city from being able to plan, study, or design or construct a light rail line. And you know, light rail lines cost money, but so do BRT, so I was surprised the BRTs weren't included, but maybe Representative Fenton's just lucky they weren't, because that's in a process right now. Section 10, page 10, section 8 is prohibiting any responsible authority from starting in this planning process, which I'm assuming the definition of a responsible authority would be the Met Council, but maybe Council can correct me on that if that's wrong. Basically, I'm stripping out the sections in here that take away local control. Local control of any project going forward. And this doesn't just pertain to Southwest Light Rail. It pertains to Botnum. It pertains to any light rail process from here on out. So I just want people to think about that as we're trying to build out a regional system and play at the big boys table and big girls table across the country. And starting down a slippery slope, because maybe they'll be looking at your project next. So I would encourage a yes vote.
Representative Joaquin, thank you for the explanation. What is your wishes? You didn't move the amendment.
I'm
just explaining the amendment.
I would like to move the amendment.
Representative Joaquin moves the A8 amendment to House File 1866. Representative Albright, as the author, your response and your wishes.
Mr. Chair, I would not support the amendment. I would encourage no votes.
Other member discussion? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the A8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Motion fails. The amendment is not adopted. The A9 amendment. Mr. Chair, for all of us. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, the A9 amendment is mine. It's what this is. It's the citizens' little recommendations. It's similar to the Frank Hornstein, Representative Hornstein bill. With that, I move the A9 amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A9 amendment to the bill author. Representative Albright to the A9 amendment.
Mr. Chair, while I greatly respect the efforts of Representative Winston on the matters of metropolitan governance, and the UNR are continuing our dialogue at this juncture, I'm in support of the A9 amendment.
Other member discussion, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would encourage a vote on this because it is the staggered terms, which I think a lot of people feel could be attainable this session, and it's much closer to what the OLA has suggested. I believe, despite what's been said here tonight, that the bill that we're seeing, the underlying bill in 1866, goes far beyond what the OLA recommendations were. So just think about that. Thanks.
Other member discussion on the A9 amendment before the committee? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the A9 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. To the bill. Members, questions on the bill? House File 1866. Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on the bill.
Roll call being requested. Member discussion.
Mr. Chair.
I will go with Representative Mason and Representative Halverson.
Thank you very much. Having served on a city council in the metro area, I do have experience in dealing with the metro council, and not all of my experiences were totally comfortable. So I am okay making changes, and I do believe that the Metro Council should be responsible to the metro communities. So I have no problems taking away the ability of the governor to make the appointments.
But that part is only part of this bill. I mean, there are so many irresponsible parts in this bill that it's unbelievable, and it makes it incredibly difficult to vote for the good parts, and especially parts one and two that make it impossible for local communities to plan for the future of the development in their cities. So again, I encourage a no vote on this bill.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. You and I have had many conversations about metropolitan governance structure, and I've talked to a lot of stakeholders. I know you have too, Representative Albright, and there are many points of agreement when we talk about work that needs to be done. There seems to be general agreement that regional planning matters. Roads and pipes and dams and trains, they cross city boundaries, they cross county boundaries, and we need to deal with those things responsibly. There's agreement that there seems to be a general agreement that staggered terms are a good idea to get some institutional knowledge continued on there. There's general agreement that it's time to generally revisit the issue of governance. And there's some agreement on some basic points like staggered terms, the need to have a greater voice of our local elected officials. And so there's a lot to agree on when we talk about the kind of reform that we're working on. And I just really want to encourage the author and others to focus on those points of agreement. And I also really want people to listen to the concerns about parochialism and the concerns about having local elected officials serve when they're telling us that that's not a role that they want to play in many cases. And it's, I keep hearing, well, they'll figure it out and it'll work out fine. I sat in this committee a couple of years ago and listened to a local mayor say that they did not need to do take care of issues around housing and other regional governance issues because the people on the other side of their border could take care of it. That's parochialism. It exists. And I think that there could be a lot of concern, and I'm sure that I have great respect for Commissioner Gerlach, but I'll go toe-to-toe to him on Eagan versus Apple Valley any day. So we need to listen to those local government officials that are telling us that they have concerns about the role that they're being asked to play in this particular bill. So I'd encourage the author to go back and to those points of agreement and really build from there, because I do think that something could really get accomplished this session because there's been such quality conversation and so many stakeholders coming to the table to have this conversation. So that work is all really good and really positive, and I thank Representative Albright for doing it. And let's find some areas of common ground on this. I think
before we go, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm done.
Okay. Before we go, our next member question, did you want to respond to what Representative Halverson said?
No.
Then we are going to go to Representative Jessup for the next member question.
Thank you, Chair Grisco. This question is for Met Council Government Affairs Director, Mr. Shetton.
Mr. Shetton, if you will come forward. So far, we've been up front here.
All good. All right.
Once again, if you could just identify yourself for the record, and then we'll have Representative Jessup go ahead and ask his question. Welcome once again.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm Judd Shetton with the Met Council. Happy to take your question.
Thank you, Mr. Shetton.
Representative Jessup.
One of the concerns I think that I have as a new member is just there's a perception in the general public that there's not as much trust in the Met Council as we would all desire to see. And certainly there are questions even here and certainly with this bill on what is the right governance structure and makeup of the Met Council. You have experience. You're working for the Met Council. You've come out against this bill, and you've talked about concerns about conflicts. What would be your recommendation on the makeup of the council and how the council is appointed, elected, or some other option. What is your recommendation on that?
Mr. Shetman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm so happy for the question. I am not happy
for that question. Mr. Chair and Representative, I am not trying to avoid your question, but that is just something that I can't answer. I have been with the council for 17 years, and I have been through three different governors, and the fact of the matter is that the entire time that I've been at the council, it is really a decision between the governor and the legislature to determine what is the best approach to how the council should be governed. And there have been a number of bills over the years that have looked at this, but my perspective on this is completely warped compared to what should be looked at between local governments, our city council representatives, and the legislature and the governor. So I am going to totally dodge your question and thank you for it, but I'm not going to answer it.
Governor Jessup, did you want to try another question this evening?
I think I'll pass.
You're 0-1, right?
You're
giving the score. Okay.
We're out there.
Other member questions at this time on House File 1866? Seeing none, the bill probably doesn't need a summary, but we will give you an opportunity at this point, Representative Albright, to have the final word.
Members, this is an annual conversation. And as Mr. Shetman said, it is amenable to a conversation for the legislature to take up. But ultimately, we have to, as Representative Halverson, who I have a deep and abiding respect for, and we've worked on a number of issues along these lines, it is ultimately, in our belief, a decision that the governor has to make in terms of what legacy does he want to leave going forward as a governance structure that will enable the state of Minnesota to go forward with growth, go forward with recognition that independent municipalities, counties, and cities have the opportunity and or the right to be self-governing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time tonight. I hope we haven't belabored the committee, but I do thank the members for the robust conversation, and with that, I will encourage a yes vote.
I will read the motion that House File 1866 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton?
Yes.
Freiburg?
No.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Lee?
No.
Mason?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Kwan?
Yes.
Samson?
No.
Trzezinski?
Yep.
West?
Yes.
Eugene?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Representative Albright, you are on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill before the committee is House File 1585, which is Representative Kwan's bill. And as a matter of fact, the next three bills that we have are all going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill. And after 1585, then we will go to Representative Pugh's bill, which is going to be House File 2040. So with that, Representative Kwan, if you'd like to move your bill for possible inclusion, and then proceed with your testimony in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to move House File 1585 over for possible inclusion. And it's a fairly straightforward bill and discussion. We've talked about special elections and voter turnout. If we set 4 dates throughout the year where we can have elections, there'll be predictability and easier for people, the voters, to know
to look, to be informed. I think when we have the random special elections, there have been turnout issues, and I'm hoping that this approach would be an improvement. And second Tuesday of March, second Tuesday of May, second Tuesday of August, and then the standard general election in November. Now, the spacing is 2 to 4 months between. The longest space is between the general election and the next one, and part of that is because January is a very busy time for government and people, and so that's why a little more time is given after the general. And I'm not saying that these months, if we have a June primary bill that goes through, it'd be logical to have the May one maybe moved to June and the March one. Those type of adjustments make sense, but I think it makes sense to where people have a predictable time when they're starting to look to see what's up for an election. And I stand for any questions.
Any member questions for House File 1585, which is before the committee? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading the brief here, and it says the bill with the DE1 amendment. I don't see any DE1 amendments, and the DE1 amendment has been pulled, and I've gone with just the language as introduced.
Okay. Seeing no other member discussion, Representative Kwan, your attempt at brevity, very well appreciated by the committee, it sounds like. So we will lay that over for possible inclusion. Thank you, sir. Sorry, I did not ask for public testimony. I knew that was going way too fast for that. We'll bring folks up.
Mr. Chair, introduce yourself and state who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I had marked my comments to be brief also. I don't have the page number readily handy, but let me just say that townships and schools enjoy a very good relationship, except when we try to share an election. And so the last two legislative sessions, we successfully separated Township Day and SNAP being an option for school bond referenda. I believe the schools are supporting that. And so I would like to just say that as this bill is drafted for the omnibus, we would like to take out the provision that that second Tuesday of March be an option for school special elections. With that, I just have a question.
Mr. Sewell, here's a quick question for you. Are you okay with the concept of having scheduled days? It's just maybe the dates don't work from what you're looking
Mr.
at.
Mr. Sewell, we are absolutely fine with the concept of the bill. And if I can't find the page right off right now on this particular section, but that, if we can take that provision out, we will be completely neutral and not have any objections to the concept.
Other questions for Mr. Sewell? See you then, Ms. Kelleher. Welcome.
Good evening, members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I'm here tonight to discuss some of our concerns with Representative Quam's bill. And let me tell you, it's a big step forward from Representative Druskowski's bill. We've got some more dates on the table. Some of the ideas we'd like him to consider, and I haven't had an opportunity to speak to him, is we ask him to consider pushing back the effective date till after the general election this year. We do believe this would cost school districts more money in the long run because school districts often combine polling places. So I think it's important to just state for the record that there is a cost associated with this. We would like some comfort language when we talk about the counties, because the counties would be dividing up how much school districts would have to pay to run their portion of the election. So we would appreciate a number that with either per voter or for a certain amount, so we wouldn't have some places that could be moved all over. So we should be very clear about what we have and what you'd be what we'd be receiving. And then we'd like you to once again, I know the August date is in there and that is the primary date. I want to suggest to you for school districts, it is really important to have some dates early on. And I presently this year we've really gone around three dates, February 7th, April 18th, and May 9th. So if you can move one back a little bit, it helps us get in groundwork spring. So with that, members, we'll end and answer any questions.
Ms. Kelleher, just the same question to you as I had to Mr. Sewell. You're not opposed to the concept, just maybe just please run over the dates.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you might be pushing me too quickly on this, but I think Representative Quam will be, he's a former school board member, he understands the issues, and I do believe we can make some headway on this.
Representative Quam, any comments?
I think the most important concept is to have dates that people are used to looking for elections and expecting, and I think that will help an informed public and also help turnout.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And requiring special events on certain dates, what happens in the case of a legislator passing away in office and the current law, the governor has so many days to declare a vacancy and then set an election date? Will they be then have to, this will be changing that so we could have a situation where it could be a long time before we fill in a vacancy.
Representative Quam, did you want to answer that question or attempt that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that this bill, as it's drafted, would not affect state and federal elections, so that what is presently policy for filling an empty seat with that type of special election would not be impacted with this. And furthermore, there's exception for disaster or emergency, and where you could go outside, and there's a definition of what both emergency and disaster are in the draft of the bill.
President Nelson, we do have a representative from
Secretary
of Defense who's going to be here on another matter tonight, but since she's been patiently waiting, we'll figure with
her. Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I asked is my first election I ran was the situation I said. We had a special election. Legislator passed away in office. The governor has 5 days. I don't believe it's still the same way, 5 days to declare a vacancy, and then it was a four-week election. And in 2 weeks, then you had a primary, and so it's if it's between us, I don't think that's changed. And so if this affected that's you could have a situation where that seat's that open.
If you want to identify yourself for the record and either confirm, deny, or clarify.
Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Secretary of State's office. Our reading of the bill is this doesn't affect state level or federal elections, so all of the same procedures for filling the vacancy in state or federal office would apply.
Thank you. Other member questions? I just want to know what the two of you are talking about. That's all I know. Other member questions? Representative Quam, any other follow-ups? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Mason. Yep, I did have you on the list. Sorry. This is only my about 6th hour of chairing meetings today, so.
I hear you. Representative Quam, mainly you're talking about special elections, so does it really make a difference to try to put them in certain months? Because I think that's an awful, I just don't think that it really makes that much difference. Because there's not going to be a consistency. The school board is not going to have a special election every May or whatever this is, like every other year or something. There's really no consistency.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mason. The idea, and having been on the school board, there are construction details that cause you, if you're going to do that type of election, you need to have an answer by a certain date. So you plan these things out, and you start the process quite a bit ahead of time, and then you would just aim at the common date, and there's easy discussion to try and maybe improve what those dates are to fit with. We can even look at distributions of when special elections have been, that type of thing. But unless you've got an emergency or disaster, you've got a period of time when you're thinking about, you're planning, you're working at, and this, I think, actually helps the process because we have to this is when we want the election, and then you say we have to have X number of days of notice, etc., and step back from that, just like you would if you're doing construction, then it helps you keep the task and handle it. But the main point is to have days so the public is used to looking, is there something coming up that it keeps people involved and should help for turnout. And when the people vote, that's the right decision. And the more people vote, I have more confidence in that decision. I'm just trying to improve turnout and the general confidence of the results.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Keith Carlson from Minnesota Intercounty Association. Since I'm the only county person here, I do feel compelled to respond to my friend Ms. Kelleher's comments suggesting some need for a cap of the costs of the counties that would be paid by the school districts. Just want to make it clear, under Article 2, the cost of administering school board elections is being shifted from the school districts to the counties under the bill. We have no specific objection to that as long as we're compensated for our cost of doing that. A covert stricture or something of that simply doesn't work. Our costs are fixed regardless of what the turnout is going to be. So I do want to discourage any such limitations on our reimbursement.
Mr. Carlson, thank you. Any other member questions or anyone else from the audience wishing to testify today? With that, now we will lay over House file. Joy, sir, yeah, John. And Mr. Carlson said he wasn't another county official. That's myself. Where are you going?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we're administrators. Thank you. I apologize for coming up so late, but I'm Troy Wilson, and I represent the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which is auditor treasurers, and recorders in all 87 counties. Just want to say that we support House File 1585, and the efficiency of uniform election dates will help create and plan and administer elections.
Mr. Wilson, thank you for your comments this evening. Anyone else? I was sure, because I don't want to mess up a third time. I think now, seeing and hearing no one, Representative Kwan, did you have any other final comments before we lay the bill over?
Just renew my own motion to lay it over.
I have a motion to lay it over, possible inclusion. You are on your way, because I think you have to do another committee here in just a moment as well. Representative Pugh with House File 2040, followed by Representative West of the House File 2050, followed with the final bill, 1192, Representative Johnson. We are getting one.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. If you're welcome, if you want to just go ahead and leave your bill for possible inclusion, lay it for possible inclusion, and we'll go with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I would like to move House File 2040 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus elections bill.
Proceed, Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'll be ever so brief. I see this as an election integrity bill. This is a companion bill for a bill that has already been heard in the omnibus bill in the Senate. Former Secretary of State Senator Kiffmeyer, it carried that bill. And basically, under current law, the county auditors are required to mail a notice of registration to all voters who registered in a polling place on election day. And so when these cards are returned, the auditor is required to change that voter's status in the statewide voter registration system to challenged. What my bill would do is require that the county auditor would report to the Secretary of State having sent notices to all those who were, in fact, let me just reference the bill itself. sure if I stated that correctly. So yes, the county auditor is going to notify the Secretary of State upon receiving information from three things. They're going to report on the total number of all notices that were returned as undeliverable. They're going to do this by precinct. Secondly, they're going to report on the total number of non-deliverable notices that the county auditor was able to determine the reason for, along with the reasons for those having been returned. And then the third is the total number of non-deliverable notices for which the auditor was unable to determine what the reason for that non-deliverable document was. And then lastly, and this would be, it's already in statute that by March the 1st, this is to occur, but then the Secretary of State is going to report to the legislature. Let me look specifically. It's going to report to the legislature, and I think that this is a real opportunity to bring some visibility to this issue of the number of documented, undeliverable voter registration cards, and as a result, the legislature can give consideration to what might need to be done to enhance election integrity. So that's pretty much the extent of the bill. The only other thing I would want to mention is that there is a fiscal note on this. The fiscal note is a total of 14,000 dollars. Is that correct? Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 2040. Anyone from the public wishing to testify on House File 2040? Seeing none, member of questions, Representative Yoakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pugh, can you let me, I was trying to look and I don't see any Chapter 13 notifications, but is this report to the legislature then made public with everybody's name and addresses on them?
Representative Pugh.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Yoakim. No, that is not my understanding. As I'm taking a look, it's just the total number. It's the total number of cards that were sent and received, the total number that were of the undeliverable cards, that then there was a determination as to what the reason was for the card, for the auditor having determined what the reason was, and then there are the cards for which the auditor, so it's just the number for which the auditor is unclear.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Yoakim, follow up.
My question, I guess, and maybe it would either be to you or the Secretary of State's office, because currently it reads that it's a random sampling. But with your bill, it sounds like every non-deliverable will have to then be researched versus a random sampling, and I just want to kind of get that straight.
Representative Pugh, we have support from the Secretary of State here today. Once again, to identify yourself for the record and proceed to answer the question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Secretary of State. The way we make the bill, it still requires a random sampling. It's just that under current law, we only report on the number that the counties couldn't determine why they didn't come back. So they might have gotten some back, and it showed that the voter moved after Election Day, and so they were able to determine that reason that the voter was eligible on Election Day, but they don't report that to us. This would have them reporting sort of all of the cards that came back, the reasons why, and then that number that we were getting before, which is the number of ones that they couldn't determine whether or not the voter was eligible until they put it on.
Representative Yoakim.
Mr. Chair, so the fiscal note that's attached is just for your office, or does it take into account the extra expense for all the counties or cities to collect the data?
Ms. Struthers.
Sure, Representative. The counties, my understanding is they're collecting this data already, they're just not reporting it to us, and so I think the fiscal note deals with the reporting structure so that they can upload that information to us, but my understanding, and I don't want to speak on behalf of the counties, but when talking to them about this, is they're already collecting that data, they're just not reporting it to us, so I don't want to speak for them, but when we asked, they thought it wouldn't be significant in their work, but I'd love to come speak to them.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I didn't realize, you know, this makes some sense in the common sense, but I got it in the mail before this bill came up, and I have it sitting on my desk, didn't bring with me tonight, but a report similar to this, I was surprised that they're not already doing this.
They being the counties, Representative Nelson?
They being the counties, they being the Secretary of State, I'd have to go down and look and see who it goes from, but there's a report that goes by county in the state, how many, they won't report it on deliverable, how many they could figure it out, and how many they didn't have at the end. So I'm surprised that we need this bill. So I guess Ms. Struthers can explain to me where that came from. And
sure. Representative Nelson, we're not going to have you go down and get the card. Just bring it to committee tomorrow. We're going to save us some time. Ms. Brother.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I dropped that report off in your office. We do a report now, but it is fairly limited in what we report on. I think the number we reported was something like 180 cards were referred on for further investigation, and this would go beyond that to show the number that came back and sort of the process and that the counties went to determine that those cards were, in fact, from eligible voters and there was no need for further investigation. So to just expand the report that you received.
Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, I would say this sounds like a good bill. And to include.
Okay. Other member questions? Seeing no other member questions and no other feedback from the public, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Pugh, thank you. Representative West, you are next, followed by Representative Clark, and then that will conclude the bill hearing for today, March 7th.
Nothing else. Brevity.
Representative West, if you want to move your bill for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill, which seems to be laid over after our hearing today.
I move to lay over Council File 2050 for possible inclusion in that possible elections omnibus.
Representative West, if you'll proceed with your bill.
I feel terrible if I had a testifier who was viciously ill.
Oh.
And she's been here for like 14 hours.
That I did not know. I'm so sorry, ma'am.
Perhaps she can get her testimony out of the way and then we can send her home.
Well, I'm good with that if you're all good with that.
Either way.
Welcome to the committee for State Janine. For the record, you probably know the drill, having been here watching it previously, so we'll just dispense with that and let you get going with identifying yourself and pursue your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jenny Gabsel. I'm the elections manager for Hennepin County. I'm here to talk about this bill tonight just to say that we support it and that it makes an already great process and product better in terms of electronic poll books, which we implemented in Hennepin County in 2016. What this will do is it will allow us to ask our voters to sign in on the electronic poll book prior to printing the slip that comes out. And that way we'll allow the voter to check the information that the election judge puts in before the slip prints out. And it will also allow us to capture their signature and have it print out on the slip in all of the places it needs to appear. When the voter registers on election day and signs in, they need to sign twice. And we found last year that sometimes a voter would miss one of the two lines. So we feel this will make that process more efficient and will make it so that we don't have to try to contact those voters to get their second signature after election day.
Thank you, and we do hope you feel better. Any member questions? Seeing none, again, thank you. And is there anyone else wishing to testify in the matter before the committee? Sir, please come up and identify yourself.
Really quick, before Max comes up here,
sure.
I just want to mention
the
amendment in your packet. Moving the amendment. It's just Max, who's about to testify, brought up some issues, and this seeks to address those issues. But since we're just laying it over, and it wasn't even close to the deadline or anything, I've talked to Representative Nelson, who's also on the bill. And we're just going to, just for your own edification, but we're not going to.
Okay, so we're just going to talk about a possible fix or a solution to something on here, but we're not going to move the. Okay, that helps us with the administration and management. Sir, welcome. Seat your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
Hello, I'm Max Halperin. I'm testifying as an individual rather than for an organization, but I did want to point out that I had served in 2013-14 on the legislative task force that drafted the current electronic roster law, and so that's the background that I bring to this. And the intent that was just laid out by the previous testifier makes total sense, and I'm in complete support of that. However, the bill as introduced, as it is before you, apparently inadvertently would have removed some of the safeguards that are in the current statute. And so that's why I'm so happy that Representative West has agreed to put the bill into better form as it becomes part of an omnibus. And I just wanted, for the record, to explain why those changes are important, what those safeguards are that are in current law. And essentially, the safeguards are all about having paper records, that paper be printed, retained, and checked. And so more specifically, every time a voter signs in or registers, the record of that is printed out. The election officials have to retain that from the standard elections records retention period, and they're checked in two regards. One is that when the county enters new registrants into the statewide voter registration system, they consult those paper records from the polling place, and the other is that when the election judges are determining the correct number of ballots to count, the match between how many people signed in, how many ballots were counted, that again, they have to count paper to do that. And those safeguards provide two properties that are important. One is transparency, that ordinary citizens can see that the electronic roster is recording those voters who present themselves and no others. And the other property is durability, that if the electronic roster system should fail after the voter signs in or registers, it can't cause alteration or loss of that record since it's on paper. And those are important because any kind of computer systems, you probably know, do fail, whether that's failure that's provoked by criminal tampering or whether that's just failure because some human somewhere was fallible. And the current statute and what I understand will be the end point of this when it's amended will ensure that even though the electronic roster system may fail, the citizens will still have confidence that the election is properly conducted. Thank you.
Sir, thank you for being with us tonight and sticking out. Appreciate your testimony.
I was glad to stick around and see how hard you all work to do the people's business. And I would be saying that even if the representative from the great district 19A weren't here tonight.
Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee this evening? House File 2050 for possible inclusion in the elections bill. Are there any member questions at this point? Representative West, we will give you the final word this evening, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Good bill. Steps in the modern right in our election process. It could be wonderful. And I want to thank Representative Nelson for being on it with me. So I will renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in elections on this.
Representative West renews his motion that House File 2050 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2017 omnibus elections bill, should there be one. Representative Johnson, before you get started, sir, I was at pensions earlier this evening, and the issue that you were a co-author on related to a certain class of employees, physical therapists, was included in the pensions bill.
I would
just let you know, because you weren't there, I was, so I would relay that to you, because I'm sure you want to know that before you went to bed tonight. So,
well, thank you very much, and you've had a good night. You've met two people from my district, and two people I deeply respected in that.
With that, I will move House File 1192 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Ag Finance, Agricultural Finance. And to that point, Representative Johnson, if you'll introduce the bill and tell us what we're looking at this evening.
Well, it's late. I will be brief. I won't get into the
I could make a strong case for the need to address workplace safety on the farm, but that's what this bill does. And part of this bill is it establishes in statute the Farm Safety Workers Group, which has been instrumental in creating a report that I think went well above beyond expectations we had in the last session, where we asked the Department of Agriculture to look at farm safety in a more comprehensive way. I have a testifier who served on that group, and I'll have an introduction.
Very good. Good evening, sir. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, who you represent, and
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Austin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Safety Council. The Minnesota Safety Council is a very old nonprofit, almost 90 years old, that deals with promoting safety for all Minnesotans, including farm safety. I will echo Representative Johnson's comments. The Farm Safety Working Group, which is a piece of this bill, is an important piece of formalizing attention on farm safety. Why is that important? Because farm safety is still the number one issue if you go to the data and you look at injuries in the workplace. It's the most dangerous workplace in the state. And so we think having the Farm Safety Working Group, in addition to some of the other features in this bill moving forward, is an important way to keep attention on farm safety. In the long haul, attention on safety is what yields results.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir, thank you. Anyone else from the public wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1192. Anyone else from the public? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as all working groups and commissions come before us, this one has a expiration date, so we can, our sunset date, so at some point we can look at this in the future. But I think this might be one that I would agree probably doesn't, we don't want to sunset, because I think, as was said here, farm safety and safety as a whole in the workplace is an important thing that needs to be ongoing. So, but it's something in 2021, legislature, there's enough time to look at it and see whether it still needs to be continued.
Thank you for that observation, Representative Nelson. Other member questions and comments? Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if from here on we have to refer to Representative Clark as the representative from the great district of 19A.
Representative Nash, I think that's the individual member's discretion. I could be wrong, but Representative Clark, I see no other questions. Given the lateness of the evening, wrap us up and take us home, as they say in drive time radio.
Oh, actually, you probably should refer to me as Representative Johnson, but that's okay. I get called Representative Clark about 30-40% of the time, and I can tell you a long story about
that. After 9 events, so we have a much broader. You know, before that, we do have another question, but okay. We're going to get around.
I apologize because I know it's late, but I was just, you know, obviously farming's been around for a long time, and haven't we ever done a working group like this in the past? Or maybe your organization has kind of filled that need in the past, maybe.
Well, I would like to start that answer, and this dates back to budget cuts again. We hear about this as relatively new members. We've lived in the luxury of solid budget footing, and you know, 10 years ago that wasn't the case. And when a person left the extension service to go to another state, this was an opportunity for a budget cut, and it kind of, Minnesota's fallen way behind on it. But as far as the group itself, Mr. Austin may have a comment.
Sir, I just want to present by yourself and then proceed.
Again, Paul Austin, the Safety Council. Safety waxes and wanes, and attention to it waxes and wanes. So there have been farm safety working groups over time, but as Representative Johnson said, there's been a gap there for about 10 years, and it's time to get it back.
Now I believe you have the final word, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and it's later. Please, I encourage you, yes, vote to pass this along to Ag Finance.
I will renew my motion that House File 1192 be referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
If opposed, the motion carries. We'll see everybody in 12 hours and 30 minutes.